Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. I feel alright tonight. I bring you precious contraband and ancient.
Alright, alright, alright. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago. And we're here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. on weekday mornings. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, like as he does every Monday morning. And we also have the Monday morning movie reviews. And as I was telling Carl and Lisa, we got a new movie reviewer with us, a good buddy of mine, Steve Procopi, who I've known for many, many, many years. And he's a terrific movie critic. A great guy. He's one of the hosts at Flashback Weekend. He and I have been hosting there since 2002, and he's going to be the new addition. We lost Jim. He is going back to school. He's got a full-time gig at Harold Washington Library as well, and Colin dropped out at the beginning of the year to take some time away and go back to school. So Steve is kind enough to step in, and he's a great guy. And so Eric and Steve and myself will review all the new movies, and we'll do box office as well. Lots of movies to talk about this weekend. Lots of movies, and we'll get into that for the Monday morning movie reviews. We are going to talk about some of the most disappointing pop culture the biggest pop culture disappointments, and it, you know, and we have a lot to discuss there, and we want to hear from you guys too. And I've also got an article about some weird gadgets from the 80s. So we'll jump into that. As always, the phone lines and text lines are wide open. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All righty then. So that's what's happening. By the way, subscribe to our podcast. Every single second of every single show is podcast. It's available. It's free. You can go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe. They will be automatically sent to you, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. And we thank you for a lot of people listen to our podcasts, and we want to thank you for that. All right, so let me say hello to Tom Hush, my producer. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, Nick. Exhausted from a big pop culture weekend.
It was a crazy pop culture weekend, man. Between Deadwood, which, by the way, we're going to review. I know it's not a theatrical release, but it's a big deal. So Eric and Steve and I are going to review Deadwood. Between Deadwood and Rocket Man and Godzilla, well, for me, Brian De Palma had a new movie that came out on VOD over the weekend. My future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo's TV show debuted last night, Perpetual Grace Limited, and it's great. And she's in it, and I was just thrilled. She's in the opening scene, too. I was like, there's Dana. It's my future ex-wife.
Right away.
So, but she wasn't lying about how good it is and how original it is. And, I texted her right after the show, and I was like, man, you weren't lying. It's really great. And so she's really, really happy to be a part of the show, and she should be, because it's really weird. And
I'm
really,
glad.
Really, to Ben Kingsley, man. Ben Kingsley, man. Oh,
well, I've been needing something new to watch now. Thrones is done.
Yeah.
Barry is done for the season.
Yeah.
What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah,
Better
exactly.
Things, you know?
That's it. They're all done now. Now, so I do have a great show now for Sunday nights to watch, because, you know, now that's on Sundays. And I would normally watch, you know, Barry and all those shows on Monday morning, but I was really excited to see Dana.
So had to get it in.
I was like, no, I'm going to watch it. I'm not going to sleep through this. I'm going to watch. I want to watch it. I want to watch it and see my future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo. But the show's great. If you have Epics, I would highly recommend it. So, yeah, it was a busy weekend. The Cubs got swept.
Oof.
Brutal. Godzilla, man.
I know.
You saw it.
I did, and I made sure to go see it in IMAX, and it was it did not disappoint as a Godzilla movie.
Yeah, no, it didn't disappoint at all. I know it's gotten terrible reviews.
Yeah.
And it didn't make as much money as people thought it was going to make.
No, I was shocked.
Yeah.
Even I was a little shocked getting the box office report.
I saw it in IMAX, too.
That's the only way to do it.
I was beside myself. But again, as I was saying to Carl and Lisa, it's specifically made for dorks like you and me.
Oh, yeah. And I was sitting, I went by myself. My girlfriend was like, I'll wait till it comes out. And I was like, that's fine. I mean, because I've been torturing her this whole week. I'm like, hey, honey, you want to watch Godzilla versus Space Godzilla? No. And I'm like, well, that's too bad. It's already in. We're watching it.
Yeah. No, it's made for nerds. There's no question about it. Like, if you're just kind of, I don't know, I like Godzilla, it's fine. It's not for you, man.
No.
This movie, it's not for you.
Until you know that you can sit through Godzilla Final Wars from 2004.
Yeah.
Then that's your litmus test.
And there are
test.
so many wonderful little Easter eggs.
I know.
That they put in there just for us dorks, you know? And I was just like, I had a grin on my face the entire movie.
I felt like a kid.
Yeah.
I felt like a child.
Yeah. So, but we enjoyed it. We're going to get into the reviews of that coming up in a little bit. Let's get to the newsroom and say hello to Vic Vaughn. Vic, how are you?
Pretty good. How you doing, sir?
All right, man. Did you have a good weekend?
I did. We got a little rained out Saturday. We'd planned on doing some things Saturday, but we didn't get to it. But Sunday, we kind of tried to cram it all in. So
yeah.
And we did get out to one thing that I always take my kids to every year is the Gold Coast Art Festival there at Butler Field. And we always have a good time
That's
so
cool.
We did that.
You had good weather for that.
Yeah, it was beautiful Sunday.
Yeah.
A little on the cool side, but I'll take it.
We were in the movies the whole time it rained on Saturday.
I know.
Because we saw Rocket Man and Godzilla back-to-back at the theater. And you know, that's like 4.5 hours inside.
Perfect day for a couple movies.
Yeah, we missed it. When we came out, it was like just drizzling, but apparently we missed it. And it rained a little bit in the evening, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I was...
should have done what you and Tom did. We should have called Saturday a movie day. We'd have been better off.
Well,
we thought we could fit it in.
Yeah, and then Saturday night, man, Ms. Svengoolie showed a classic piece of crap Saturday night. Billy the Kid versus Dracula. It's one of the most ridiculous John Carradine performances ever. And I had a blast watching that because that movie is ridiculous. And it was funny because Kurt Russell's dad, you know, was an actor and he's in it. He's in that movie. Have you ever seen that one, Vic? You ever seen Billy the Kid versus Dracula?
I didn't know you were being serious.
Oh,
no.
Totally serious. No, it's a real movie. Svengoolie showed it on Saturday night.
It sounds great.
Oh, it's so, and you know, obviously Rich had a field day with it because it's such a ridiculous movie, and all the jokes and the bits that he did in between the commercials and stuff were fantastic. Such a stupid movie, and John Carradine. Rich told the story about how John Carradine considered it to be by far the worst performance he ever gave in a movie. And he's right. It was the most ridiculous performance I've ever seen. And it's such a stupid movie. But it was great. And, you know, I mean, that's why you watch. Oh, man, you know, next week, Svengoolie is showing one of my classic favorites from the 70s. You ever see the movie The Car, Vic? With James Brolin?
No.
It's about a devil-possessed car that terrorizes a town.
No, I haven't seen it.
Yes. Unbelievably ridiculous movie, and one of my favorites of the 70s. One of my favorites. 1977 it came out. And the car itself, the actual car, is like an original design for the movie. The car really looks cool.
But
it's,
oh, really?
It's not a real car. They designed it specifically for the movie. It's one of the coolest looking movie cars of all time. The guy, and I can't remember, I'm blanking on his name, the guy who designed the Batmobile and the monster car.
Oh, yes.
The Batmobile, the Burt Warden and Adam West Batmobile. That one. The coolest one. So he designed this car for The Car. It's such a stupid movie.
He's kind of a legend in his own right for that type of thing, isn't he?
Watched
a documentary about it, yeah.
Yeah, he's a complete legend.
Yeah.
No question about it. So, all right, well... We're starting off the work week, guys. It's Monday morning. We're going to break. When we come back, we will review all the new movies with Steve and Eric and myself.
Walk along Hollywood Boulevard.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. And it is Monday. That means it's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke because it's a jokey time coming up a little bit later on. We are going to talk about some of the biggest pop culture disappointments of all time. And we are also going to talk about some gadgets from the 80s that were ridiculous, like many things in the 80s. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, on Facebook.com/Nick D Show as well. Okay, a little change here in the lineup. Our Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress is with us. Colin Suter dropped out at the beginning of the year to pursue some other stuff and go back to school. And then we lost Jim Leskowski last week. So coming in to save the day is our good friend Steve Procopi, who has been on the show several times, and he has been kind enough to step in and be a permanent member of the movie review squad here on Monday mornings. So first of all, let's welcome Eric. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, making his debut. Steve Procopi, how you doing, Steve?
I'll hold for applause while everyone calms down. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is very exciting.
I appreciate you stepping in, man. I really do.
Of course. Of course. I'm happy to do it.
Give everybody a little background where you write and what you work and all that cool stuff so people get to know you.
Currently, film reviews can be found at Third Coast Review. Some interviews that I do can also be found there, as well as places like Slash Film, just various freelancing outlets. And then I'm also just, like 3 months ago, started as the public relations manager at the Music Box Theater, and now I'm doing this. So.
Yeah.
Because I don't have enough to do. So.
All right, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Well, congratulations on the gig at the Music Box, man.
Yeah.
I know how much that place means to all of us. So
sure, yeah.
Very, very cool. All right, we got a ton of stuff to talk about this week, so we should just dive right in. Why don't we start off? I mean, it's not in movie theaters, but it was, like, for me, one of the events of the weekend was Deadwood, the movie. Eric, why don't you tell us about Deadwood, the movie? We'll give that a review for people who want to watch it on HBO.
Right. Well, Deadwood, the series, many people know, had three seasons on HBO back in the early 2000s, and had a kind of a abrupt surprise cancellation, much to dismay of not just its cast, but its legions of viewers.
Yeah.
But you know, we were told at the time that David Milch was actually going to be given the opportunity to sort of write a couple of follow-up movies to basically sort of close out the remaining storylines and whatnot, but that didn't happen. They dismantled all the sets. Everyone went their separate ways, and somehow, miraculously, you know, more than a decade later, we have been given an opportunity to have this conclusion to Deadwood, which is just basically what it is. David Milch wrote the screenplay for it, and it takes place, I think it's like 10 years or
yeah,
something like that after
yeah,
the events where we last left the series. South Dakota is being admitted into the Union, and so a number of people from the town who were once prospered there or lived there are actually returning as part of a celebration. There's so many characters to go through.
Yeah.
We don't want to, you can't give away what's going on with everyone, but Timothy Oliphant is back as Bullock. The great Ian McShane is back as Al Swearengen. And time seems to have sort of taken its toll on Al. His health is very much waning, and he's kind of a symbol of not just what the town is sort of becoming now that the America is sort of moving on with the future, but also, you know, kind of a surrogate for Milch himself, who has actually been diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a really kind of bittersweet kind of send-off that we have going with Swearengen. Not that he's not his usual ornery self, for certain, but it's all part of this storyline that involves bringing back Hearst, Senator Hearst, played by Gerald McCraney, who is sort of the de facto villain of the third and final season, and how the events that transpired at the end of that season are all sort of coming back and folding onto one another. It involves cover-ups and murder and attempted murders and stuff. while everyone is basically going to try to survive this final showing. So, I mean, you know, like I said, this is kind of a bit of a miracle that we even got this thing. Is this exactly how we wanted everything to, how we would have imagined everything would have concluded after the final season? Maybe not necessarily, but, you know, unlike, you know, what some people have disappointments with series that do have a regular succession and then go on. I could mention Game of Thrones for some people, not myself, but people were really disappointed in that finale. I don't see how they can be dissatisfied with what transpires here. This is a really terrific send-off to the show and to these characters. It's rich with, you know, a lot of the themes and the ideas that really perpetrated through that show for the three seasons. The dialogue is as rich as ever. The characters, it's just so great to be in the presence of all these people again, and to see many of them get a proper goodbye in many ways, that is just really quite satisfying. And that's the word that I kept saying to myself watching this the premiere Friday night, is that it is just so entirely satisfying. There are so many things about it that just made me just want to leap out of my chair in enjoyment. I've watched it like 2.5 times this weekend, just rewatching certain scenes, and there's so many wonderful moments, and the performances are great, and it just, it's so wonderful. I mean, I can't, you know, just, you know, get past that part of it, that it's just so uniquely satisfying to have an end to the show, and I think it ends it on a really kind of perfect note, but with a lot of finality. There's a lot of things that happen in this episode that bring closure to a number of things, and I keep saying the word, do so in an immensely satisfying way.
Yeah. Okay, Steve, what about you, man?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. One of the things I thought maybe benefited the show getting cut off the way it was that the temptation a lot of times when a show like this enters a final season is to kill off characters. But they didn't get a chance to do that, so there's so many people to bring back.
Yeah.
And there's so many people to wonder about. Like, another mark of a great show or a great movie is that years later, your mind kind of sweeps over that show and wonders where those people ended up. And this is like one of those very rare opportunities where we get to see that. And it is immensely satisifying. Every so often I just stop and go, I can't believe I'm watching this. I can't believe this is on. Let me just call out a couple quick people. I mean, specific performances. This has got to be Robin Weigert's Emmy nomination. Like she's
unbelievable. She's unbelievable.
She was always good in it, but there's something about the way that her character arc goes in this movie that is so deeply wonderful. And not everyone gets that kind of moment in this because there's just too many characters, but certainly the character of Charlie Utter has a really important role to play here. Obviously, Ian McShane is always good, but he's also probably the most sympathetic he's ever been. Oliphant is great. I completely forgot some actors that were in this show, to be honest. I was also really, it wasn't just last year that we saw Brad Dourif, was it a flashback weekend?
Yeah, he was a flashback with the weird facial hair.
That's the first time it really hit me this is happening.
Yeah,
because I heard him say to his daughter in the elevator, he couldn't, she said to shave your mustache. And he's like, I can't because of Deadwood.
Because of Deadwood,
Because he was literally going from flashback week into Deadwood. And I love the way that the very minimal way they use flashbacks in this, just to remind us of everything. It's not like a huge flashback thing at all, but just enough to remind us where these people stand with each other or with the town. The language, Eric mentioned the language. It's even denser and like you can't improvise on a show like this. It's like half Shakespeare, half Mamet. It's just like it's every word means something and specific, and you can't change it, and you wouldn't want to change it, but you might have to put on the closed captioning because it's so dense and so wonderful. Yeah, and then, of course, like I was also really impressed with Molly Parker in this. It was my absolute favorite Canadian, period. I think she's great in everything, and I was so happy to see her come back in this. And I deliberately didn't look to see ahead of time who was coming back and who wasn't, and was really pleasantly surprised to see that pretty much everyone came back, including people I thought were dead. I was surprised that Garrett Dillahunt wasn't back in this as, like, a third new character.
Yeah.
So, But anyway, yeah, it really does have a finality, but it also, I mean, I don't think they're going to make another one, but there is still that room in my head now where I can think, okay, so I'm going to think about these guys again for the next 20 years and, like, wonder what's going on with them, because things are left open-ended too. So, they resist the temptation to just kill a bunch of people. It really worked. And I was surprised because I was nervous about this one. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Cause you don't want to ruin like a perfect run like this show had, but yeah. This is a perfect capper.
Yeah. Okay, guys, hang on. Okay. I'll tell you what I thought of it. We got to take a break. Steve Procopi is with us now. He's our new reviewer. Eric Childress are here, and we're talking about Deadwood, the movie. It's a movie, but it's not in theaters, but we had to talk about Deadwood. I mean, you couldn't not. So we're going to take a break. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Deadwood, the movie. And then we got a ton of other stuff to talk about too, right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are back, and we're live here in the Allstate Skyline studio till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and our new buddy here, Steve Procopi, who has now joined the team here, will be part of the Monday morning movie reviews. Before the break, Eric and Steve told you what they thought of Deadwood, the movie. And I think I just lost Steve. Can we get Steve back on the line? That's a nice debut. I cut the guy off on his first morning. Well, anyway, you know, we'll get Steve back on. Let me just say, I echo everything you guys said about Deadwood. I thought it was phenomenal. And I was really looking forward to it, and I loved the show. And it was everything that I had hoped it would be. And then even more, I think. You know, getting to see these characters again, being back in that place, listening to that incredible dialogue and watching these actors just go at it again. And it just it brought back everything that I loved about the show while I was watching it. It was incredible. There are a couple of few things that I do want to mention. Here's Steve.
Hi, sorry.
Hey, welcome back. Sorry about that. Well, welcome to the show, Steve, by cutting you off.
Wow, technical difficulties on the first day.
Exactly. Right. Well, we're back. I was just saying to Eric, Steve, that I echo everything you guys said about Deadwood. It was absolutely great. And again, you know, we've used the word now 50 times, satisfying, but that's exactly what it was. And it was just a real joy to get back into that world. And, you know, as you guys mentioned, the language is even deeper and more significant. I got to say that I did not expect to be as emotionally wrecked as I was by it. And I think that there's a real heft to it because of what's going on with Milch in real life. I mean, it really added a lot, you know, a lot of emotion to while watching, you know, the show, while watching the movie. And I didn't expect to get teary-eyed, but I did. And on top of that, I mean, just watching all these guys do their thing and Robin Weichert, man, I'm telling you, she's everybody's unbelievable, but she's the standout for me. And that emotional ride that we went on throughout the series was there, and I think, you know, tenfold. It was hard to see all these people come back and not have Powers Booth there. That was a little bit, you know. That was a little something, you know, because he was such a great part of the show, you know, originally. Mm-hmm. And so he was definitely missed. But this is a triumph as far as I'm concerned. It's an absolute triumph. And it ended it was incredible because it was so, I was one of those people like you guys who was so pissed off when they canceled it.
Yeah.
I was so angry. I was like, well, how, what? What? And then we have to wait all this time, but we finally get the payoff here. This is a huge, huge payoff. And I'll tell you something, man. Friday night, 7 o'clock, I was right there. I was right there, man. I did not DVR it. I did not wait. 7 o'clock, I was on the couch in front of my TV watching the Deadwood movie, and I loved every second of it. So,
well, no Powers Booth, but we did get Jeffrey Jones back.
Yes,
so.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
Yeah, that was.
I was not expecting him.
Yeah,
nope.
Yeah. So great stuff. Great stuff all the way around. So Deadwood, the movie, it'll be, you know, repeated 900 times on HBO.
Yep.
It's available on HBO Go. So, I, you know, if you're a fan of the show, you got to see. Well, you probably watched it. That would be my guess. If you're a fan of the show, you probably watched it. So, all right. Let's see. Hey, Steve, why don't you tell us about Domino?
Really? Okay. Have you ever wondered what it's like to have a really talented director not care about his plot or characters? Let's talk about Domino a little bit. Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who plays Christian, a Copenhagen detective, who he and his partner go to a domestic disturbance call, and they find out that it might actually be a murder when they confront a suspect in the elevator, and Christian has forgotten his gun, so he has to borrow his partner's gun, even though his partner is guarding the prisoner. While he goes to the scene, they haven't even been to the scene of the crime yet, and they go there, and of course the prisoner not only escapes but stabs the partner in the throat, and he ends up dying. So basically the film then turns into, I will give the film credit, the bad guys in this movie are ISIS. They're not some, like, random terrorist group that doesn't actually exist in the world.
Yeah.
It's ISIS.
Yeah.
And I feel like that takes a little bit of guts to just name it like that.
Yeah.
But I'll give it credit there. But it turns out that this guy who stabs his partner isn't exactly the criminal they think he is. He did commit the murder, but he's also, in a way, being forced to by ISIS. And it becomes a pursuit across multiple countries. Carice Van Houten, again, also from Game of Thrones, like Nikolai is, it becomes his new partner, and she, it turns out, has a bit of a connection to his dead partner that is not that hard to figure out, even though they hold off telling us what it is for a while. Guy Pearce is here as a CIA agent who is trying to keep this escaped criminal from the Danish police for his own selfish reasons, because he'd be a great informant against ISIS. And there's a little bit of a cat and mouse game here, but man, it feels like someone who grew up loving Brian De Palma films aping Brian De Palma. It does not feel like it's the master making his best work, and it just felt like he was going through the motions. He's reusing tricks, visual tricks that we've seen him do, the split screens, the sort of steady cam through crowded venues. We've seen this all before. I don't even think the acting is very good in it. And these are very, Guy Pearce is kind of funny in it, but everybody else just likes, they are not being guided through this story the way they need to be. It's a very short film, which I'm guessing wasn't always the case, because it feels very choppy and rushed, and there's not a lot of time for just getting to know these people. And therefore, I didn't really like them very much, which you don't have to like characters to like the movie, but I think in this film it might have helped a little bit. The surprises aren't that surprising, and the tension isn't that tense, and I kind of just hated it. So that's about all I got to say.
Well, I hated it too, Steve, and I'm one of the biggest Brian De Palma fans.
Yeah.
And apologists. Listen, I think Raising Kane's a masterpiece. That's how much I like Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
So this is two in a row for him that I think are unwatchable. This his last one, what the hell was it called? Passion?
Passion.
Yeah, awful. Absolutely awful, and going through the motions, and this is just, I mean, this barely qualifies as a movie. It's so bad, about half an hour into it, and I was like, what the hell happened to Brian De Palma, you know? He doesn't make many movies. His last really great movie, I thought, was Redacted, And I thought that was a terrific movie. But he made that one already when he made Casualties of War. It's basically the same movie. So, but this is just like, I mean, it's like, okay, I guess I should do split screen here. I guess I should do a slick camera move here. You know, there's a set piece on a rooftop at the beginning of the movie that feels, like you said, Steve, like somebody trying to do De Palma. And it just was, it is a terrible movie. And it's not shocking that it went straight to video. It's not shocking that it's 88 minutes long. It's just shocking that Brian De Palma's got his name on it. That's about it. It's a terrible movie. And it pains me to say that about one of my favorite filmmakers on the planet, but man, it was bad.
Because, you know, I mean, there are certain directors like De Palma and a few others that I won't name that you kind of want to put out to pasture a little bit, that it seems like they're past their prime, that they're not, you know, they're doing stuff by rote kind of thing, you know, but even you think of like guys like even like Sidney Lumet, for example, like you know, had did a lot of, you know, rote stuff for years, and then before The Devil Knows You're Dead, they're like, oh my God,
yeah,
you know, he's back. You know, so you keep hoping that, you know, I'm watching Domino, just like, maybe this is going to be it. This is going to be his comeback. This is going to be the one. And after that rooftop sequence, I would have settled for 88 minutes of tricks.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it seems like this is what you enjoy doing, Brian.
Yeah.
Just do it the entire movie, because you don't care about the characters. You don't care about the plot. I certainly don't care about whose affair the partner is having with the former partner. Like, what was that?
I don't know.
What the hell was that? That's the character motivation, and that leads... I don't want to go too far, but I'm just like really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's absurd.
It is
an absurd movie. And like you said, Steve, the only person that seems to be providing any energy at all is Guy Pearce, and he's bad in it.
Yeah.
You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, at least he's energetic, but he's not good in the movie. I mean, I think he read the script and went, oh, man, does this suck? So I'm just gonna ham it up as much as possible. Yeah, this is a disaster, and it pains me to say that because I love Brian De Palma. But okay.
If I'm not mistaken, he's not particularly happy with it either.
Well, he shouldn't be.
I think I've heard that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if somebody took it away from him or what, but at this point,
yeah,
they should just take the cameras away from him.
I agree.
Mm.
All right, you guys, hang on, okay.
Yep.
All right, Steve Procopi, Eric Childress, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio on a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the biggest pop culture disappointments, and we're going to talk about weird gadgets from the 80s and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Right now, though, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me here to do the movie reviews. Let's get back to it. Steve, you're there. Oh, I didn't hang up on you. Okay.
I'm here.
All right. And Eric is here as well. Welcome back.
Yes.
All right, Eric, I didn't get a chance to see this when you guys did. I was very curious about it. tell us, Eric, about Ma.
Oh, okay. Well, this is the latest from Blumhouse Productions and director Tate Taylor, their first collaboration, I believe. But the film stars Octavia Spencer as a woman who works at a veterinarian's office or kill shelters. One of those two. I don't remember if it was actually clear. I think it's a vet office. It is a vet office, yeah. And one day she is approached by a group of teenagers to buy them alcohol. She's a little reticent at first, but does agree to buy them all the alcohol they want. And in fact, even eventually gives them a place to consume alcohol. the alcohol in her the basement of her house. And soon it becomes a thing. The new girl in town, played by Diana Silvers, who's also in Booksmart, currently in theaters, her and her mom, Juliette Lewis, have just moved to town, and she's making new friends, so she becomes part of this little clique that becomes involved in having parties in Octavia Spencer's basement. Some cracks in the armor begin to show. Octavia's character, who she says to call her Ma, might have ulterior motives in what she's doing with these kids. It seems very clear that not necessarily that she's out of balance, per se, but that she's definitely got something up her sleeve that is kind of dispersed throughout the film. We kind of get an idea bit by bit exactly where she's kind of going with this plot. That's about all we really want to say about the plot in general. This is a film that it reminded me of the kind of like exploitation films from the 60s and 70s that were very low budget and kind of had something to say, were not, fully fleshed out to say something of great importance, but the fact that they were saying anything in kind of a cheap exploitation, piece of trash, kind of up the stakes a little bit, kind of gave it a little bit of nuance and gravitas that people sort of remember those films for. I don't think many people are going to be remembering this film in particular because I think that, for one, Tate Taylor is not a good filmmaker. This is the guy that did The Help, Get On Up, the James Brown biopic, and The Girl on the Train. And here, he's got so much meat on the bone to be playing with here as far as themes are concerned and what's going on with Octavia Spencer's character and through the flashbacks and instead of treating this like a mystery and that everything's going to be revealed in the end, he keeps flashing back to what really occurred with her, and so there is a bit of a sympathetic view that we have towards this character, even though we suspect it's sort of leading to a sort of, a really, kind of gross payoff in a way. But it seems like at every opportunity, this movie just seems to pull its punches, and so by the time it gets to its final act, it doesn't have the kind of impact. In fact, it doesn't even really go far enough as far as kind of cheap thrills are concerned, and I think that's kind of a disappointment, with the exception of sort of one hilarious moment involving Octavia driving her van. I don't think anything else that comes after it even comes close to matching that. And like I said, just like Tate Taylor, I saw this interview that he did, and he actually, someone asked him about the idea about what Octavia Spencer's character is going through as far as in relation to race, considering that the trauma that this character has gone through is always has been at the hands of kind of privileged white teenagers, and Tate Taylor just completely dismisses it out of hand, as if there's nothing to that.
He did direct The Help, Eric.
And this is a guy, he directed Get On Up, so yeah. Clearly this guy knows how to pull his punches.
Yeah.
He avoids them, is what I'm saying. Anyway, I kind of sat there just like, why, what was everything leading up to? Why would you take these certain routes that sort of miss the point of everything you're going for? Because it's all right there. It's all just sitting out there waiting to be plucked. And then when it just kind of avoids all that, it doesn't even deliver on the finale that you're expecting, or that you really kind of want at that point in some sort of, satisfying way. While Octavia Spencer's good, she's always good. I really like her a lot in just about anything, particularly in a movie called Loose that's going to be opening later this year. I just think that this movie is a real missed opportunity, and I was really disappointed with it.
Okay. All right, Steve, what'd you think?
Basically the same. The real question is what is Octavia Spencer doing in this? Because she's not clearly, and she's a producer on this film too, and she's not afraid to punch instead of pulling punches when it comes to dealing with race in films. Why would she make this film? And I almost wonder, especially the scenes where we see her as a teenager in high school, she seems to be like the only black kid in the school, or one of the only ones at least, and you kind of wonder if that's the motivation for all of the things that she goes through. Then why not deal with it head on? It feels like a series of missed opportunities in this film. And she is good, but at the same time, this isn't an Octavia Spencer performance like anything we've seen. And I mean that she doesn't really seem to be giving it her all. I don't know if she was. I don't think she was embarrassed by it, but she should be, and she probably will become embarrassed by it as time goes on. But it's just a real baffling film that like nothing. There's nothing sort of endearing about any of this, or like none of the characters really struck me as being particularly. Like, I didn't care about any of these teenagers. Like, there's nothing about these teenagers that would make me think this woman would want to be, would allow them to even come into her home. And even when we realize why she is, I kind of wonder why she's taking so much of it out on the kids and not more the parents, who is the one she has the real issues with. It's a confusing and kind of ugly film that I will never think about again.
Okay. All right. There you go. All right, that's Ma, and not recommended by Steve or Eric. Steve, why don't you tell us about The Tomorrow Man?
Okay, here's another disappointment with some great actors in it. This is the feature debut from a writer-director named Noble Jones, who had made some short films and music videos that were pretty popular. It's less a film about two older people finding each other than... and the two older people are John Lithgow and Blythe Danner, who I mean have been in millions of good films. And it's more about it's more of an acting exercise from these two wonderful performers who really aren't doing their best work in this sort of quirky, not especially interesting look at the way people view the immediate future. Lithgow plays a guy who was a former systems analyst at a factory, and he's a man of numbers and data and planning. And the thing he's planning for in his older age is this sort of vague idea that the world is going to come to some sort of global crisis. And he wants to be ready for it, and he probably won't happen in his lifetime, but he still wants to be ready for it. And it's a bit of a mystery for a while how he's getting ready for it, but we find out pretty soon. And then sort of during one of his trip to the grocery store, he spots this woman who Blythe Danner plays, and he's intrigued enough by her that he sort of arranges to meet her in the parking lot, and pretty soon they're dating. And it's sweet and kind of funny because she's more laid back and doesn't think about the future and thinks too much about the past, and that has some weird implications about her, the way she lives her life, which is more of a mystery in this film. But the reveals aren't that interesting, I don't think, and I don't know. I guess I didn't. I was more worried that these people needed to be in therapy than with each other. So I kind of lost interest pretty early. They're not bad. Certainly, the performances are not bad. It's more the writing, I think, that suffers. The directing's fine too. It's actually a beautiful film to look at. But the writing is probably the problem. But I don't think the messages that Noble Jones is trying to get through to us here are really hitting it on the head. And then there's a whole family drama with Lithgow's family that doesn't really amount to much. So it's a bit of a wasted opportunity. Not a terrible film, but certainly skippable.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Steve Procopi, Eric Childress are reviewing the new movies. We've got a few more to review here, right here on 720 WGN. We'll do it right after the break.
Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that
everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive on this Monday morning. And because it is Monday, that means it's movie review times. Eric Childress and our new critic here with us, Steve Procopi. We've seen a bunch of movies. We got more to review. And let's welcome Steve back. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Eric, tell us about The Perfection.
Okay, I'll give it a shot.
Better you than me.
I don't want to say too much about this movie.
Oh, yeah, it's true. Yeah.
The setup of the movie is that Allison Williams plays sort of a former cellist, very talented cellist, who at a young age had to drop out of a very prestigious Boston music school because her mother was terminally ill. Though she sort of hung on for a while. While she was nursing her, basically lost all her opportunities within the music world. But after she passes, she does come back to the music school that is run by Steven Weber. They are sort of admitting this new student played by Logan Browning. She's now the star pupil. The two of them, Allison Logan's character, female, form a relationship and go on a little excursion together while some illness might be happening around the area at the time. That's all I'm going to say about this plot. Because one of the joys of this really sort of beautifully structured and directed horror film is in the discovery. It's a film that is actually divided into the three parts. It's three acts, or almost like three different movies in many ways, although they do form a cohesive whole. Watching this movie and not really knowing what it was about, other than Allison Williams played a cellist, is the right way to go into this film. And it's a film that, strikingly very early on, it's rare with a horror film these days that I get very unsettled.
Yeah.
And there is a scene early in the film that takes place on a bus.
Yep.
And anyone who's had stomach problems can relate to what goes on that bus. And it was very uncomfortable to watch. What then occurs afterwards is equally troubling. And then the movie takes a different direction from there, but leading to, again, some very satisfactory comeuppances throughout the film. This is a film is sort of kind of very, very much of the time. It's very perfect for culturally things that are going on as far as I guess you could say female empowerment in a way, but certainly also instances of Me Too and toxic masculinity and organizations that use their power for really horrible things. Like I said, just go into this movie. You'll come out of it, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe in a good way. You are forewarned about it, because it is very unlike most of the horror movies you're seeing these days. But it owes itself a lot to a lot of really classic stuff. Cronenberg, for example. I left this movie what I think is a perfect final shot.
Mm-hmm.
I love the final shot of this movie. I can't recommend this movie highly enough.
Yes.
Which played at our Chicago Critics Film Festival too.
Right. And it's on Netflix. That you can
yes.
see it, you can see it now on Netflix. Steve, what did you think?
Nick, you probably maybe have a similar reaction, especially with horror films. I grew up watching them. I still watch probably more horror films in a year than any other kind of film. If a horror film can surprise me,
yeah,
I give it points and will more than likely recommend it just because that doesn't happen very often. And this film, the whole ending especially, but not just the ending, really took me by surprise. And some people might find this film unwatchable, but they won't find it unforgettable. I should mention the director, Richard Shepard, who did stuff like The Matador and The Hunting Party. I did like a dozen episodes of Girls, which probably explains the Allison Williams connection. And he also, I think, just did one of these new Twilight Zones for Jordan Peele. So, but man, it has sort of a Black Swan vibe to it at times because the two girls do form a very close relationship. There's a great duet where they're playing their cellos together that is shot like a sex scene, and it's really cool. And again, never seen anything like that before. So bring it. That film at one point, I think we can say this sort of doubles back on itself.
Right.
And shows us some things around that bus sequence twice, and or more. I guess that's not really exactly right, and that's fine. You don't need to know exactly what it is, but it just opens up the film in an entirely different way at a certain point. And as Eric said, the less you know about this going in, the better. And to the people that at our Critics Fest that love this movie, they love this movie.
Yeah.
And I think the ones that didn't were not quite sure what to think.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And this is we've comfortably warned people that this is a movie that's not for everybody. I thought it was great. And like you, Steve, it surprised me. And again, just like you, I see 9,000 horror movies a month, and and this one was genuinely surprising and really got under my skin, no pun intended. But it really it worked, man. It really worked. I thought about this movie for a lot when it was over. I just kind of sat there going, wow. And I think we have to make sure that Allison Williams starts making movies where black people should not be suspicious of her. I think that's a pattern that might be happening here. This is great stuff. I mean, if you're a horror fan, this is the deal. And it doesn't hold back. It goes for it on every level. And Steven Weber's hilarious in it. I just wanted to mention it. I love Steven Weber in the movie. I really did. He was so having a blast and having so much fun. And again, beautifully directed movie. Like really, really beautifully directed. So I highly recommend it. This is for horror fans only, though. And this is a movie that, being a horror fan, even I went ooh during a lot of it. But I thought it was great. So it's on Netflix and it's called The Perfection. All right, cool. Okay, let's see. Steve, why don't you tell us about Eric? You didn't see Rocket Man?
No, I did.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, good. Steve, tell us about Rocket Man.
The more I thought about this film since I saw it, the more I really liked what it did. I, it's funny, I've already spotted think pieces about this is Elton John biopic in quotes. And breaking down almost scene by scene, figuring out which scenes are truthful and which aren't. I'm like, wow, in a movie that labels itself a musical fantasy, the concept of truth is more of a recommendation than a requirement. So I'm not really sure that really matters as much as some people think it should.
Well,
in this,
Steve, here's the thing.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to do with, the reaction that Bohemian Rhapsody.
Of course. I get it.
I mean, I despised Bohemian Rhapsody. It is. I thought it was awful and completely inaccurate. But this movie, and we'll talk about this. We're going to have to break here. This movie is a fantasy. It's a musical. It's a fantasy. Mm-hmm. So people who are taking umbrage about how that it's inaccurate. What the hell? I mean, what?
I know.
What,
I know.
I mean, I don't understand. I mean, at one point he's playing the piano, he floats in the air. That doesn't. That's not. Is that an inaccuracy? No.
I bet you to the people there, it was not an inaccuracy,
right,
though. And I bet
right.
you they all thought they were floating just like they are in the movie.
Yeah. So. All right, hang on, Steve, because we got to take a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk more about Rocket Man, which is the film about Elton John, and we'll talk more about it coming up right after. And also, doesn't help that the guy who shadow directed Bohemian Rhapsody actually directed this. So that makes the comparisons even more. All right, we'll take a break and come back, talk about Rocket Man after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. On a Monday morning, that means my dad's going to tell a joke. It's also Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews with Steve Procopi and Eric Childress. And let's get Steve back. Steve, welcome
back.
Hello.
Yes.
Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve, continue to tell us about Rocket Man.
So, as I was saying before, it's not a straight fact, you know, like scene-by-scene factual biopic, but they do hit a lot of key moments in his life from when he was a child to, I think this goes up to about the mid-80s when he finally goes into rehab and then takes the rehab seriously. What it does, remarkably so, is it uses the lyrics to his songs, and I should mention Taron Egerton plays and sings Elton John's music, and he's amazing, both as a performer and a singer, who knew, the lyrics that Bernie Taupin wrote, which, you know, they knew each other very well, so he could write to a degree about Elton's struggles and his pain from his childhood and just feeling unloved from a big part of his life, but they used the lyrics as the storytelling device. And this is a full-on musical, and I don't want to, everyone should know, they've done kind of a weird job of hiding that in a lot of the trailers, but this is a musical. People are breaking out into song in the middle of moments you would not expect it. It's not just like an on-stage kind of musical or recording studio musical. It is everywhere, and the songs aren't necessarily even from the era they're portraying, which I found fascinating and kind of gutsy. But, man, I mean, I was not fully aware of Elton John's childhood. He had a rough life. His father left him, his family, when he was young, and the mother, who Bryce Dallas Howard plays, he was left with, wasn't a gem either. From the way the movie portrays her, at least. The framework of the film is an AA meeting that he's in full costume for, because he's just walked off stage in his AA meeting, and he just sort of tells his story to these strangers. I got to give Jamie Bell a ton of credit for playing Bernie Taupin. He's also remarkably good and, as we already know, can sing really well. I also want to call out Richard Madden, who used to be on Game of Thrones, to play Elton John's first manager, John Reed, and I guess first male lover, who was a bit of a snake and a seducer and milked the guy for a lot of money and worked him to the bone and didn't care that he was turning into a substance abuser. I could almost make a case for Richard Madden to play James Bond, though, after seeing him in this role. It's this sort of got these fantastical edges to it, and it's in this realm of magical realism. And if there's ever a life story to be told with magical realism, it's Elton John's. And the costumes are all there, and the glasses, and there are some great performance moments. But man, it just kind of wants to be the total package, and for a large part it is. And they aren't just using songs that you know, but they're using a lot of songs that you know. I think they're just using the best songs for that moment. And you mentioned Dexter Fletcher is the one who directed this. He and Edgerton made what I think is an underrated film called Eddie the Eagle a couple years ago together, and they clearly have a great relationship. And yeah, it made me a little nervous that this is the guy that wrapped up Bohemian Rhapsody, but I think we know where a large part of the flaw in that film lies.
Yeah.
Not with him. So, but man, I just enjoyed the hell out of this thing. I wasn't sure if I would going in.
Yeah, okay. All right. What about you, Eric?
Well, first, I think it's kind of interesting that apparently we're going to have nothing but Game of Thrones actors playing John Reed until the end of time, considering that Aidan Gillen played him in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Right.
So that's kind of funny. And not to, you know, belabor the point in Bohemian Rhapsody, but, you know, I mean, we are sort of in close proximity to that Oscar-winning movie. And like you, Nick, I just despise the hell out of that movie.
Yeah.
But not only Queen was not the only music that I really got into as a kid, but there was a lot of Elton John in my house at the time too. I heard a lot of his music first on like compilation albums, actually, and then that led to discovering his music elsewhere. But the Bohemian Rhapsody thing, one of the things that I thought that where that movie could have improved, considering that it was just going to take a giant on history, that they might as well, since it was just going to be about the music and people are just going to walk away going like, damn, that was really good music, that it should have just been the rock opera. Maybe not the one they made that everyone thinks isn't particularly good, but you just craft a whole new rock opera around it. And this feels like they took that advice that was out there. Dexter Fletcher maybe saw what transpired after Bohemian Rhapsody and said, like, you know what, we're going to go this route with this movie. And I think it's the right choice. And I was very skeptical very early on in this movie, the minute he walked into that AA meeting. I was just like, oh, it seems like they're like we're already starting with the walk hard cliches in a way that he's gonna tell you all about his life before, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I think that some of the transitions into musical are a little awkward sometimes. It just seems like someone just goes, okay, now, instead of there being kind of a build up to the moment. So for about halfway through this movie, I was sort of kind of going back and forth, liking the musical numbers individually, the drama, maybe not quite so much, but as the film just kept developing and I was sort of drawn more and more into Edgerton's performance, who I think is magnificent in this movie. I think Edgerton, does stuff as Elton John. And Rami Malek, every time I was watching him as Freddie Mercury, I felt him acting. Like, I saw him acting with his teeth. I saw him doing that. And then the way that Edgerton and Fletcher, they give their own spin on the songs themselves, not just commenting on the action, but giving you, not the classic recordings that we're all used to. So putting them in, spinning them like a musical, I thought was a really smart choice as well. I think Jamie Bell is also very good, that these two performances kind of carry the movie. And I wish Steve sort of mentioned the Taupin being there at these key moments in Elton's life, though a lot of the stuff, was written before he knew Elton, and at least in the beginning of the story. And I wish there was more of those moments like the Your Song moment. Yeah. Those are the moments in these sort of stories that I really get into, the discovery of the music, the creation of it. And I think that's one of the best scenes in the movie. And I wish there was a bit more of that. But bringing this thing sort of full circle and watching Edgerton's full immersion into Elton John, again, I think it's just magnificent in this movie. And then getting up to the point where the movie catches up with itself and gets into the rehab scene, there's more power to it. Because it wasn't just like, hi, I'm Elton John, and I'm wearing a flamboyant costume, I'm walking in an AA meeting, and that's how we're going to start this movie because, y'all know who Elton John is. No, there's real power to that moment later on in the film. And I found myself kind of unexpectedly emotional by the end of the story. I bought this sort of turnaround and ending on that one song. I thought it was a little odd that they ended with the music video of that particular song. It's actually one of my favorite Elton songs from the 1980s.
It was a recreation of the video. It wasn't
It's not a recreation. They just put Edgerton over Elton John.
Oh, they just put him over
it's
Elton
the
John?
Exact video.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, kind of badly.
I know it well.
So I thought, because that's a very cheesy music video, and I thought that was, I wish they would have created their own, finale for that. So I thought that was a little weak. But that song has meaning. And way, like Steve said, that everything is commentary on each other, I think works. So, it's an up and down movie for me, but ultimately I was very much won over by it.
I loved it. you guys have to understand that when I was a kid, Elton John was my hero. Adored Elton John. He was my first, really favorite musician and songwriter, and throughout the 70s there was for my money there was like nobody better on the planet. So I was a joy during this entire movie, and he is unbelievable in this movie, Taron Egerton. He's unbelievable. Not only is it a great performance, but man, he can sing, And I totally now forgive him for the Kingsman movies, completely. Jamie Bell is fantastic.
In which he rescued Elton John.
Yeah, yeah. But Jamie Bell is fantastic, and they really, really were very, very smart in emphasizing how important the relationship between Elton John and Bernie Taupin was, and how what a major part of his success that was. And I loved all the musical numbers. I thought it was really bright and joyous. I thought all the performances were good. I really thought Bryce Dallas Howard was an interesting choice to play the role, but she's really good in it. And I was moved by it. There were moments in the movie, because I love his music so much. And this movie takes place in the wheelhouse when he was great. You know what I mean? Like, this is the best material, the time period, the best material that he ever did. And there were times in the movie when they were performing the songs or doing musical numbers when I teared up, because I loved the music so much and I was so emotionally invested in this story. Now, granted, you know, we've seen stories where, you know, talented musician, self-destructive, does drugs, drinks a lot, has to go to rehab. We've seen that. That's a cliche in and of itself. But the way they handled it in this movie, not only do they tap into the emotion of it, not only the accuracy of being an addict, but they do it in such a beautiful way. And I'm going to say this, and you guys are both going to get it. It reminded me a lot, in terms of style, of Across the Universe. And I know you guys hate that movie. Everybody hates it but me. I love that movie, and it reminded me of Across the Universe. And I mean that as a compliment.
And now I hate Rocket Man.
You tainted this movie
No, I'm sorry, man. It did. It totally reminded me of Across the Universe.
And many the Paymore taint on it.
Many, many spots. But no, this is top-notch all the way across. It's beautifully imaginative. It's beautifully directed. Obviously, the music is fantastic. And I loved it. And I didn't mind. I think it was right to close with I'm Still Standing, because that was like that was when he came out and said, hey, look, I had some issues, and now I'm good. I'm standing. I'm going to continue. And I think it's perfect that they ended that way.
The song choice, I have no question.
It's the video.
I just think that the music video homage was a little weird.
Okay.
Right, Eric, except that in the context of this film, suddenly that music video doesn't seem so outrageous.
Yeah, it's true.
It feels like part of the movie.
Not
outrageous, it's just cheesy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, but I do want to mention one thing. One thing that disappointed me. I think this is one of the best movies of the year, and I loved every second of it. I kind of missed that they didn't do Someone Save My Life Tonight. Because mm-hmm. I think that's one of his best and most important songs, you know, and most personal stuff between him and Bernie. And they got the suicide attempt in the movie, mm-hmm. But they don't have the song. And that was the one thing that I was like, man, you know. So anyway, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
They got Don't Go Breaking My Heart in there.
They did. That actress playing Kiki D, that was awesome.
I laughed out loud in the theater. I'm just like, yeah, all right.
Well, it's my dad's favorite Elton John song. So when they we saw it, and when it started, when they started singing, he's like, oh, I love this song. So, all right. I'm highly recommending Rocket Man. I know Steve is too. And Eric, you're kind of on the fence, but you're recommending it.
No, I'm not even on the fence. I'm recommending it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Hang on, guys. We have a little movie about a lizard to talk about right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. It's Monday. My dad's going to tell a joke, and we've got the movie reviews to continue. One more movie to talk about. Steve Prokopy is a new addition to the show. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so I do have to say this, that the two movies that I saw on Saturday were both both subjects that were a major part of my childhood. like a major part of my childhood. This next one was also a major part of my childhood. We already covered Elton John, and now we're going to cover Godzilla. Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Eric, tell us about it.
Okay, well, this is actually a direct sequel to Gareth Edwards' sort of 2014 reboot of Godzilla, although this one, although many of the characters, supporting characters who appeared in that movie, also make appearances or cameo appearances in this film, there's a new set of protagonists, in the human world at least, in an opening that, well, all I can say is, reminiscent of Batman versus Superman, where we get sort of a different perspective of the carnage that took place at the end of the 2014 film. We see the husband and wife of Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga, two scientists who were there in the middle of all this carnage, and actually lose their youngest son as a result of it. They still have a daughter, who's played by Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things, and fast forward several years later to present time, and Godzilla has disappeared, but there are other sightings of other creatures or titans around the world that are frozen or about to be unfrozen. Vera Farmiga has developed this sonar thing that allows them to potentially talk to the Titans, communicate in some way to basically say, don't crush us. Kyle Chandler, they're the two of them, are estranged now, and he wants nothing to do with this, but he's called back into action when people realize that the sonar thing might be happening and some of these other creatures may be unleashed, and surprise, surprise, they all are, eventually. Many of the creatures that Godzilla nerds will have a lot of fondness for, like Mothra and Rodan, amongst others, and it's all leading to a lot of carnage and a lot of humans talking to each other in bunkers, trying to figure out how to stop them. And that goes on for the extent of over 2 hours. But unlike the 2014 film, which I kind of liked, I didn't think it was great, but when it did finally get down to going full Godzilla on us, I really enjoyed it. Not so much with the human characters, and it seems that they've tripled down on the human characters in this film. There's a lot of them in bunkers and looking at military screens, communicating with one another, trying to figure out how to contain what eventually could be, end up being the destruction of all living things if these creatures, don't stop fighting each other and wiping things out. There's some twists and turns to human characters, one dumber than the next, even by dumb monster movie standards. The behavior of some of the characters that are supposed to be smart with big ideas are stupid beyond belief. But even dumber than that is that I couldn't believe how exceptionally bored I was watching this film. This is a movie that unleashes this one monster, and there's a thing in the fight, and then there's another monster unleashed, and there's a thing, and there's a fight. And the whole point of this movie, I thought, was we were going to finally get some real monster-on-monster action, like we got a bit of at the end of the 2014 film, and you have to wait so long for these creatures to get together with one another. And even then, it's immensely dissatisfying, primarily because the visual effects artists and the people who made these movies, for some reason, just want to set everything at night, set it during inclement weather. I was reminded of watching Pacific Rim all again, which is a movie inspired by all these films. I'm not saying Pacific Rim Uprising was good in any stretch, but at least it was set at daylight. I gotta say, man, I think Rampage is a better film than Godzilla King of the Monsters, because again, at least it takes place in daylight, in broad daylight. You can see the carnage that's going on around them, and there's a sense of real goofy fun about it. This movie actually kind of takes itself way too seriously to have any sense of fun with. And I had zero fun with this movie, with the exception of, you know, waiting for Ken Watanabe to, you know, speak his next line. Every character in this movie is an idiot. Kyle Chandler is horrible in it. His entire performance looks like he's just 1 minute away from having to go to the bathroom in every scene. And Vera Farmiga's character and her motivation is so idiotic that I when she says the line in the movie, "We're doing this for Andrew," I was just like, "You got another kid, idiot!" That's all. I wanted to scream that at the screen, but I'm like, "Okay, if you're just going to give me some monster and monster action, I'll wait for it." And I waited and I waited and I waited, and then it's at night and it's at inclement weather and it's dark and murky and you can't see anything and it's boring on top of it. I think this is a terrible film.
Wow. All right, Steve?
I do not think it's a terrible film. As unfair as it might seem, this film is really out to get, like, the Godzilla geek crowd. Like, this is, like, the one that's sort of built for, like, the decades-long fans, which isn't, like I said, isn't entirely fair to people that aren't obsessed with Godzilla movies. But I will say that, like, dumb human characters is nothing new in Godzilla movies, and too many human characters and too much talking is not new to Godzilla movies. And I'm not saying that makes it any better. I'm just saying I kind of went in expecting that, especially when you look at the cast list. And I'm always sort of impressed by how many really cool actors they get in these more recent films. But if they're not, and they got to give them something to do or they're not going to show up. And yeah, if they're way overwritten and there's just like, we don't care as much about what's going on with the humans. I barely remember what the intricacies. I did kind of dig the idea that there's this, I don't think Eric mentioned, there's like a sort of an eco-terrorist group running around in this
yeah.
that thinks that letting all of the Titans free will be good for the Earth because it's going to kind of reset the Earth, not destroy all humans, although that's certainly a possibility that they really don't seem to be considering enough, but they just want to sort of pare down. It's like basically the Thanos effect. They just want to pare down the population by a significant amount and just start from scratch and hopefully work together with the monsters, which doesn't seem likely, but at least they think that's going to work. But I dig the idea that at least that was sort of a part of it. That was, like, just ridiculous enough to be fun. But, yeah, I mean, just having these particular monsters, Ghidorah and Mothra and Rodan, that's basically the cast list of the Ghidorah three-headed monster film from 64. And I thought that was really great. It delivered on that one thing that I really wanted to see. And it was sort of hinted at the end of Kong Skull Island that there are all these monsters out there. And we should mention, this is also, it's not a sequel to Kong, but it is in the same universe. Kong is mentioned, although never seen, which kind of bummed me out a little bit. I thought we might get a little tease of him here, since this film is setting up the Godzilla versus Kong movie next year. But I guess they're just saving him for that. But yeah, I mean, the nighttime stuff, I mean, I just sort of grown to expect that from these movies, and it's a little bit annoying. It was more annoying to me in the 2014 version. Here, at least they try to explain it by saying that the monsters are so huge and so powerful that they're disrupting the atmosphere and they're causing these weather issues everywhere. They're bringing it with them to a certain degree, which again, it's really just a cheap way that they can sort of skimp on the special effects, but
that's right.
The epic quality of these fonts, I think the design quality of the monsters is great. I think that the fight sequences are giant and big, and like they don't spare, like the entire city of Boston is leveled in the course of this film, which is going to make a lot of people very happy, I think. But yeah, as much as I would have liked to have seen it, big and bright and colorful, it just seems like more horrific to have it be darker and there's lightning and there's just fire and whatever else they're spewing, like nuclear whatever they're spewing out of their bodies. I very rarely give a pass to films that I think aren't quite living up to certain expectations, but like Godzilla movies, there's so many of them at this point, you kind of have to that we have certain expectations for them, and this, I think, beat the expectations that I had, certainly. I mean, yeah, like I said, too many characters, very for such a simple story, but no, I was fully entertained by this thing.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on. I'll tell you what I thought of it when we come back, and we're talking about the Godzilla movie, and then Eric will stick around, and we'll do a quick box office rundown for you, too. All right, that's all coming up right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in, tell a joke, because it's Monday morning, and it's also Monday morning, which means we got to wrap up the Monday morning movie reviews. Here is Steve Procopi. Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so I love this movie. Here's the thing, and what you, Steve, what you said is absolutely right on the money. This movie is specifically made for Godzilla nerds. That's it. And I happen to be a Godzilla nerd, and I had a great time with this movie. There are tons of Easter eggs in it for people who are nerdy like I am when it comes to Godzilla movies. The choice of the monsters that they have in this movie, I had no idea Rodan was in it. When Rodan showed up, I was like, yeah, you know, and Rodan, of course, turns out to be the jerk that he always is, because Rodan is the biggest jerk of the Titans in the Godzilla franchise.
Mm-hmm.
The human interaction. I mean, I thought Bradley Whitford was funny. Millie Bobby Brown just basically screams and cries throughout the entire movie. The motivation, especially by Vera Farmiga's character, is really stupid. But I don't care about that. What I want to see is buildings being destroyed. I want to see giant monsters fighting each other, stepping on people. And there's a lot of that. And it's quality stuff. And it's classic, classic Godzilla characters made by filmmakers that clearly know these movies and love these movies and are giving a gift to the dorks like me. Now, I don't know if the hardcore, you know, people who aren't hardcore Godzilla fans, I don't know how they're going to react to this movie. They probably won't like it nearly as much as I did, because I'm the target audience. I am absolutely, completely the target audience for this movie. And I ate it up, man. I saw it in IMAX. It was big. It was loud. There's a lot of destruction. Godzilla was cool, and Ghidorah looked fantastic. I loved the whole the head growing back moment, which is one of my favorite moments in the movie. And again, I don't care about the human stuff. Whatever's happening, I just want to see destruction, and there's plenty of it in this movie. And I'm really looking forward to Godzilla versus King Kong. I'm really looking forward to it. And they even set up another one at the very postscript. Movie that they're going to do a little bit later on, and I stayed for the postscript because I thought I was going to get to see Kong, but I didn't. But they set something else up, which was really unexpected. So, you do get a little picture of Kong though during the last credits. You get a little picture of him.
That's
the only thing that you get.
Yeah.
But no, I'm the target audience. I loved it. I ate it up, and I think Godzilla fans, Godzilla dorks, like my producer Tom. Tom is a fully admitted Godzilla dork. On Friday morning during the show, we both wore Godzilla shirts to work. That's how.
Nothing wrong with it.
So there you go. All right. What's next week? We got the Secret Life of Animals or whatever the hell that.
Secret
pets?
Life of Pets 2, yep. And Dark Phoenix.
Oh, Dark Phoenix, another X-Men movie.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Perhaps the last.
It's more Game of Thrones actors.
Yeah, with more Game of Thrones actors. They're getting work all over the place. Steve, we'll talk to you next week. And again, thank you for coming in and welcome, buddy.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely.
For having me back next week. That'd be awesome. Thanks, guys.
Great.
I'm glad I passed the audition.
All right, buddy. Take care. Steve Procopi did a great job for his first night, first morning. All right, let's get to some box office real quick. Now, Godzilla was number one, but
yeah.
it made 49 million.
$49 million.
Now, that's disappointing, right?
It's very much so. especially the early estimates. You know, everyone writes stories now on Friday, like sort of like midday, like where the sort of the numbers are progressing very early on. And Godzilla, the numbers it was putting up very early on Friday were very positive. It had a very good Thursday night, so the numbers were actually being projected in sort of the low 60s, which is still far down from what Godzilla made in 2014. That made $93 million opening weekend.
No, it did?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it barely crossed over to 200. So the word of mouth was not great on that one, but I think it might actually be even worse on this one.
Wow.
$49 million. I mean, now they have to start looking very heavily at, you know, how much they're going to be spending on Godzilla versus Kong.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to get that postscript movie that you saw.
Yeah, that's maybe it's true. Yeah, you're right. Wow, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
Aladdin chugging along, making more money than I ever thought it would.
Yeah, Guy Ritchie's out of jail again.
Yeah, that's too bad. $185 million in both. I really thought that this wasn't going to do nearly as good as it's doing.
No, it held remarkably well in the second weekend. So, yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Number three, Rocket Man, $25 million. Is that about where they thought?
Yeah, that's probably exactly what I thought it was going to do. And, I think word of mouth will probably be pretty good on it.
Yeah.
Whether it makes it or not, I don't know. But it's a good start.
Yeah. And then Ma, $18.2 million, and probably didn't cost anything, right, Blumhouse?
$5 million it cost.
Oh, man, wow.
Yeah. It's already in profit.
There you go. Number five, John Wick, Chapter 3, $11 million, bringing his total up to $125.7 million.
Yeah, it's going to be one of Lionsgate's biggest hits.
Number six, Booksmart, with $8.6 million. Let's see, Pikachu, the little detective Pikachu dude, $130 million that movie's made.
Yeah,
jeez.
Yeah.
But what about Brightburn? That's a disaster, right?
Brightburn dropped 70% in its second weekend,
and nobody went to see it in its first weekend. Really,
barely. Yeah.
Wow. And then The Hustle rounds out the top ten, $33 million. That's all it's made.
Yeah.
Wow. So what are we looking at? The Secret Life of Pets Part 2 will be number one?
Easily.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be an easy number one next weekend.
Dark Phoenix,
And I think Godzilla's going to drop pretty heavily.
Yeah, I think you're right. So there you go. All right, well, that's what we're looking forward to next week. Godzilla underperformed, so now we're looking at the Secret Life of... now, that first one made a lot of money, right? The Secret Life of Pets?
Oh, yeah. Over 360 million.
$360 million. Wow. Okay. All right. All right. Well, cool, man. Hey, thanks a lot. And we will talk to you next week, Eric. Okay. See you later. There you go. Eric Childress, everybody. There you go. That's the box office. Those are the movie reviews. And we're going to take a quick break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Vic, you know that came from one of the albums that you listened to and that you really loved.
Did it? I was shaking my head to it. What was that?
That's Brown Sugar by the Stones. It's on Sticky Fingers.
Yeah, I love that album when I listen to it. This is one of the problems with blowing through these is,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
They all kind of blend together after a while. But as you, if you guys are regular listeners, you know that Vic is trying to... give himself some musical knowledge because he had none.
Pretty accurate statement.
And so he's been listening to albums nonstop from the top 100 albums according to Rolling Stone of all time. And we get updates every Friday on what he's been listening to and what impressions he's making on him. So there you go. I see a spider, a tiny spider hanging from one of the lights here.
That happened in here last week as well.
Oh, yeah, no, there he is.
Huh? See, the little tiny spider is hanging from a little web. Now he's pulling himself up.
Let's welcome our next guest in the studio, Light Spider.
Yeah, Light Spider.
You have to charge him rent around here.
Yeah, what's going on there, man? All right. I thought it was on the TV because it's like the light that I'm looking at is like right in front of the TV screen. And I thought it was on the TV screen. And I was like, what's it? Oh, nope, there he is.
So, you say it's coming from one of the light fixtures?
Yeah, well, you know, we got these lights that are around the room.
That's where one came through here in the newsroom last week.
Is that right?
Yeah.
There's a whole mess of them.
What's going on, man? So, All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I'm just going to watch this. He's just going down, coming back up and going down. He's getting a little exercise, little Spider-Man. So,
where's Jeff Daniels when you need him?
Yeah. Wait, no, John Goodman, right?
That was Jeff Daniels in Arachnophobia?
But John Goodman is the exterminator.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff Daniels is the lead. John Goodman's the exterminator.
Ah, okay.
I've only seen that movie once because I didn't like it, but I remember because the only thing I liked about that movie was Goodman. He was the only thing I liked about that movie. Directed by Frank Marshall, if I remember correctly, the man who didn't know Congo was a joke.
See, and he knows all this about the movie. Saw it one time, yet I can't even recognize that song that was on Sticky Fingers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm a dork, so there we go. Well, welcome back, everybody. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We are going to talk about what are the biggest pop culture disappointments for you. Inevitably, you're going to be disappointed by a piece of entertainment. Some of that has to do with complete hype. Like, there's no way that the project can live up to the hype. Some of it is, you know, inevitably a sequel. You know, disappoints because the first one was a movie that you loved so much. What do you guys think? What were some of the biggest disappointments in pop culture for you? 312-981-7200. In TV and movies and in books and in music and all that stuff. 312-981-7200. Biggest disappointments in pop culture. What's the first thing that popped into your head, Dan?
Either the finale of Lost, which Dan loved.
Yeah.
He was really into it. I can't see his position on it, but, you know... He's.
I guess
man.
Did this pop up? This popped up because of Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah.
This story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, when I was in about fifth grade, I want to say the fifth Harry Potter book came out, and I was pretty into Harry Potter growing up. Not like some people my age who are like fanatics, but my mom brought it home for me. I didn't ask for it. I was gonna
What's
get
the
it
fifth
for-
one.
The Order of the Phoenix,
okay.
Which is by far the longest one,
yeah.
In terms of book.
Yeah. I mean, I've read them all.
Yeah.
So, how many are there?
There's seven.
Seven.
Total, yeah, there's right. seven total. And I didn't even ask her. I was just planning to get it from the library when my school got it. But my mom went out to Borders, brought it home for me, new Harry Potter book. I was pretty excited, and it was total. I really hated it. I really hated every moment of it.
Really?
Yeah, I was super not into it. And this is not because it was a long book or anything. I read plenty of long books. I read The Lord of the Rings once a year.
Well, and on top of that, the Harry Potter books got longer and longer as
they
went on.
Yeah, but the Order of the Phoenix was incredibly overstuffed. I found it to be super boring. They were just talking about stuff I didn't really care about. Going from, like, I mean, the fourth one was all the high action of the Triwizard Tournament, and they're fighting dragons, and Voldemort's back, and you're like, wow, this is gonna hit a fever pitch, and then it just didn't. And I really just was super lukewarm on the rest of the series. It really hurt.
What's your favorite movie of the series?
Prisoner of Azkaban or Chamber of Secrets, even though Chamber of Secrets is almost 3 hours long and like way too long for a kid's movie.
Is it Chamber of Secrets is almost 3 hours?
240. It's about 245.
Really?
Yeah. And I love that one because it had the giant snake. It had the giant basilisk thing. And I thought that was super cool.
Prisoner of Azkaban is my favorite.
Yeah. Directed by Alfonso Cuarón.
Well, yeah.
It's genius.
But it's also the least faithful of the movies to the books, mm-hmm. which is why people don't like Prisoner of Azkaban.
Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite, but that's my favorite movie. My favorite book is Half-Blood Prince. That's my favorite book of the series.
See, and I never got into it. I never got into it, even though it was aimed at my age and it was just so melodramatic at times.
And they killed Dumbledore in it, man.
Yeah. Yeah, but
so, here's the thing. I just want to mention this because when that book came out, what was that like?
I'd say that was about 06.
05, 06, something like that?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Okay. I was on the air, and I had just gotten the book, and I didn't even start it yet. I had just gotten on the book. I just gotten the book, and the book was at home waiting for me to read it. And I was on the air. It was on a Friday night. I was on the air, and someone sent me a link. This was before I got on Facebook. I didn't get on Facebook till like 2000. I don't think anybody got on Facebook till like 2008, 2009.
Yeah, that's when I did.
So this was before Facebook. But somebody sent me a link, like emailed me a link, and I clicked onto it, and it was a meme of it was Tom Hanks from Castaway, and a plane went across the image. So it was like a GIF, actually.
Yeah.
The plane went across the image, and it was one of those planes that had
The skywriting,
it was an actual sign.
Oh, like a banner. Yeah,
banner. Yeah. So, and as it was, someone sent this to me, some listener sent this to me, and I click onto it, and it starts, and the plane starts to go across the thing, and the scrawling comes out, and the sign says, Dumbledore is dead. I could have killed this listener.
Oh, my God.
I could have killed him.
That's just rude.
No, it's awful. It's awful. So I knew, before I read the book, I knew that Dumbledore died. And I'm sorry if I'm spoiling this for anybody, but these books are like 15 years old now. So,
yeah.
And the movies, you know.
They've been out just almost as long.
Yeah. You know, it's really funny. When I saw the last part of, what the hell is the last one called?
Deathly Hallows.
Yeah, Deathly Hallows. When I saw the second part of that movie, I went to the Davis Theater. Yeah, and we stopped over at Ricochet's, had a couple of drinks beforehand, and went. And when I walked in, I was like, you know, everybody was, you know, the place was packed. We went to the midnight show when it, you know, the Thursday night midnight show. So it was completely packed. But I knew the manager of the Davis, so they had seats roped off for us, so we didn't have to worry about it. And so we get in there, and I'm looking around, and I'm like, everybody in here is in their 20s, you know. And I was like, I'm thinking to myself, this is a kids. Why aren't there no kids here? They're all in their 20s. And then, like, the idiot the guy who was with me goes, hey, idiot. There was about three or four of us. One of them goes, that's because all these people were, like, really young when the first books came out and when the first movies came out. And they've grown up with it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because I remember reading it I was in kindergarten. But I was pretty good at reading, so I read it myself in 1999, the first one. And I was hooked for a while. I was super hooked.
I started reading when I was really, really young. The comprehension level wasn't massive because the first author that I started reading was Poe. And Poe is still my favorite writer of all time. But, like, I can't imagine, like, I was, like, 5 years old reading Edgar Allan Poe.
You just start dressing in all black.
Which, you know, like, it explains...
Talking about the fragility of life.
It explains a lot about my personality, I think, because at the age of five, I started reading Poe. And you know what it was? You know, it was right around that time. And then I got really obsessed with the Vincent Price, Roger Corman movies.
Sure.
At a very young age, even though a lot of those aren't very faithful to the...
They're an interpretation.
Yeah, but they're awesome. They're fantastic. I actually think that Tomb of Ligeia is the best of all of the Corman Poe movies. Tomb of Ligeia is just unbelievable. They're all fun, or they're all really good. And Vincent Price, man, come on, he's the man. So, all right. Well, so that was a disappointment to you. This is the
big disappointment.
I gotta say, I mean, there's a few, but I remember being so excited, you know, as a kid, being so excited for Jaws 2.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
So excited. Because, you know, when I saw Jaws in the theater, I was 10 when that movie came out. And, you know, that, obviously, it's a great movie, a completely great movie that we all know now by heart. You know, I've seen it 8 million times, one of my favorite movies. And I loved it so much. And then when Jaws 2 came out, I think like 2.5 years later. And that was 2.5 years of me. Because when Jaws came out, I saw it in theater. But the first time I saw it was at the Gateway Theater at Lawrence and Milwaukee, which is right around the corner from the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. It's the Copernicus Center now, but it used to be the Gateway Theater. And that's where I saw Jaws. And I saw it a bunch of times, and then I became obsessed with sharks. And, you know, they had, like, everything was shark-related after Jaws came out. Like, there were 9,000 different new shark books a week that would come out. And so I became sort of obsessed with sharks. And this went on from all the time, all the way up until the release of Jaws 2. And we went, my parents and I went to see Jaws 2 at the Gulf Mill Theater on a Saturday afternoon. And it was unbelievably packed. Like, there was not an empty seat. And I think if I remember correctly, there might have been people sitting on the floor of the theater. And this was a Gulf Mill Theater. And it's so stupid. Jaws 2 is just so stupid. Do you remember how they kill the shark in Jaws 2?
It's been that long. I haven't seen it probably in about 10 to 15 years.
Well, because it's not worth seeing.
Yeah, no. I only own the first one. But although I kind of want the revenge just because.
It's awful. Yeah, but I mean, that one's so awful, it's funny. You know what I mean? And Jaws 3D is the same way. Jaws 3D is awful because I saw that in 3D and that was it. But I had no, you know what I mean? I had no expectations for that. I knew that would suck. But Jaws 2, I was like, oh, even though Spielberg didn't direct it, but Roy Scheider was in it and Lorraine Garay was in it. And I was like, okay. And it was so terrible. It was just so dumb. And here's how they kill the shark. This is how Roy Scheider kills the shark. There's a giant electrical, a giant black electrical cable. It's about as, you know, about as thick as like a sub sandwich. Okay. And it's this black electrical cable. And he's in the water and he's on like a, I can't remember if it was like a dinghy or something. He's on the boat and he's got a paddle. He's got a boat paddle. And he's smacking the big giant electrical cord. He's smacking it to attract the shark. He's smacking on it. I just remember this. It's so stupid. And he's smacking on it. And then the shark jumps up and bites the electrical cable and sizzles to death.
Oh, my God.
That's how they kill the shark in Jaws 2.
Wow. Now, I have to presume it's a different shark.
Oh, yeah.
Because they blow the other one's head off.
No, Bruce gets blown up in the original. Smile, you son of a... you know? But there's a different shark in each one of them. But the funniest one, when you mentioned Revenge, the fourth one, you remember the tagline for that movie? It was, "This time it's personal."
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the shark had a vendetta against Lorraine Garay.
Yeah, and that's like a legendary headline, "This time it's personal."
Stupid, so stupid. But see, that movie's fun to watch. Jaws 2 is just dumb. And it's got the most... I remember the thing about Jaws 2 is I remember it had the most annoying teenage characters ever. Because it's a whole bunch of like young, like 18 year olds out on the boats.
Right.
And they get picked off one by one. There's a lot of crying and a lot of screaming. And they were the most, I just remember them being the most annoying characters. I was like, I was rooting for the shark. I was like, please eat these kids. Please. But that was a massive disappointment for me. The hype machine behind it and how great Jaws was. Yeah. And of course, you know, I was young. I was like 12 when the second one came, 12 or 13 when the second one came out. And I was so disappointed. I remember just like being depressed afterwards.
And when you're 12 or 13 years old, every like new movie that comes out is supposed to be the greatest thing.
Right. So what are your biggest pop culture disappointments? They're bringing this up because the Game of Thrones, the final episode of Game of Thrones, was considered a massive disappointment by a lot of people. But again, hype, buildup, and stuff like that, expectations. So inevitably, you're going to be disappointed by some sort of piece of entertainment, and we want to know what your biggest pop culture disappointments have been. Text or call us right now at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get back to this. And the article was in the AV Club, by the way, about the pop culture disappointments. And we'll talk about that and get yours as well. All right. Today, it's a matinee test versus baseball's best as the Cubs square off against Mike Trout and the Angels at Wrigley today at 3 on WGN TV Sports.
The best Chicago sports conversations start here every weekday morning. The Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Townstone Financial is synonymous with great rates, low closing costs, and phenomenal service to the thousands who have completed purchases and refinances with us since 2002. Hi, my name is Barry Sterner, owner of Townstone Financial. Let's hear about the Townstone experience from one of our customers.
I'm Christopher Nowak, a real estate agent with Castline Properties here in Chicago. When a buyer contacts me with questions about the loan process, what type of loan products are available, it's easy for me to put that buyer in touch with Townstone Financial and specifically Zach Schwartz, Barry Sterner, the whole team over there at Townstone. I have confidence that the team at Townstone is going to make me look good. The result at the end of the experience is that the customer is always happy with the service they receive.
Remember, nobody values your business more than Townstone Financial, and I'm always available to answer your questions. Call me now at 312-896-2110. That's 312-896-2110. Or go to townstone.com. That's TOWNSTONE.com.
Townstone Financial is licensed in Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida. NMLS 136639. www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org. Housing lender.
Honey, what are we going to do with your grandparents' old coins and jewelry?
I'm pretty sure they're worth some money.
You've been saying that for years.
Okay, how about PGS Gold and Coin? They're the best when it comes to selling family valuables.
And you know this because...
PGS...
PGS. When it comes to your valuables, they're the best.
Do that again.
PGS. PGS. When it comes to your valuables, they're the best.
Isn't that the place Jeff sold his grandmother's jewelry when she passed?
Yep. He checked out PGSGoldAndCoin.com and found tons of positive reviews. He was blown away by how much he got. Do you? Oh, you're already on the site.
Almost. PGSGoldAndCoin.com.
PGS Gold and Coin, the upscale way of selling your coins, jewelry, diamonds, and collectibles. Family-owned and operated for over 10 years. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau with 3 Chicagoland locations, and they make house calls. PGSGoldAndCoin.com or 888-416-2701. That's PGSGoldAndCoin.com or 888-416-2701.
PGS, PGS, when it comes to your valuables, they're the best.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 o'clock. It is Monday, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And, yeah. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. The lines are open. The text lines are open as well. And we're talking about your biggest pop culture disappointment. You know, there's all the hype. Maybe it's a sequel to something. Maybe it's an album. You know, we've already mentioned Tom was very disappointed by the fifth book in the Harry Potter series. The first thing that popped into my mind, although there are several movies and TV things and music that I've been disappointed by, but the first thing that popped up into my head was Jaws 2, as I mentioned, because I love the first one so much, and it was just such a cultural thing. And I remember everybody was really excited about Jaws 2, and you could feel it in the theater. Like I said, it was at the Gulf Mill Theater. There was not an empty seat in that place, and everybody was so excited. And like 45 minutes into it, everybody was like, oh, God. So what do you guys think? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 630 area code says, Jen DeSalvo recently tweeted about a spider coming in, and she resisted people telling her to kill it. Now, this would be, with Jen DeSalvo, that would be in the newsroom. So, because I'm in a different studio than other people use. Oh, now he's crawling on top of the light, little dude. So there's a little teeny spider that's been hanging out here across the room from me, hanging from a little light that's on the ceiling that surrounds the studio. So there he is. All right. 262 area code says Highlander 2. I'm still confused, but love the first one. Yeah, I can see people being disappointed by Highlander 2 because the first one was pretty cool. First one's pretty cool. Because it was Highlander 2, The Quickening, right? Wasn't it called The Quickening? Yeah. 765 area code. The second Highlander was called The Quickening, right?
I believe so, but I'm not exactly a Highlander person.
Yeah.
I was never super impressed by the first one.
I like the first Highlander.
It's like cool. It's got Sean Connery in it.
Yeah. Lambert. It opens up with wrestling, professional wrestling. Yeah. So right there, you know. But yeah, Highlander 2, The Quickening. I remember seeing that and thinking it was a piece of crap. 765 area code says Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, the two greatest superheroes of all time deserve better than this. It was an awful movie.
Yeah. I remember I took my younger brother, he must have been, 14, 15 years old.
To Batman versus Superman?
Yeah, I hadn't visited from college in like months, and so I hadn't seen him in a long time. I was like, hey, we're going to do a whole big day out. We went to Woodstock, we did like a little Groundhog Day stuff, because he likes Groundhog Day, and then I was like, alright, let's go see Batman versus Superman. He was hyped, and I've never seen him that disappointed in his life.
Yeah.
Seriously, in a piece of media?
Yeah.
And he had zero expectations.
Yeah. See, I didn't. I went in with no expectations whatsoever. I went in with real low expectations, and it met those low expectations.
There are people out there that will bat for that movie, though.
I don't understand that at all.
Oh, man, it's so weird. They're like, nah, Zack Snyder's a genius, man.
This is a terrible movie. 309 area code says everything after The Empire Strikes Back.
Disagree.
Are you counting the J.J. Abrams movies, too?
It seems like. There's a lot of people that hate that one. They hate the Rian Johnson one.
Well,
I loved it.
I love the Rian Johnson.
I think the last one.
I think the Last Jedi is great. But my favorite of all of the new Star Wars stuff is Rogue One. Rogue One is my favorite. I think it's my favorite Star Wars movie of all time is Rogue One. Because I'm not the biggest Star Wars guy in the first place. Like, I didn't like Jedi at all. Star Wars is fine. Empire I like a lot. Empire is terrific. But everything after that, no. The prequels, no. But then the reboot stuff that J.J. Abrams has made, I like both of them very much. Mm-hmm. I liked Solo. I thought Solo was good.
That was fun.
And I love Rogue One.
Well, that's your boy Gareth.
Yeah. Yeah.
He turned around, did Godzilla, brought him back, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'll do a Star Wars.
And I'll tell you why, man. Rogue One, everybody dies.
It's great.
Everybody
and you know it going
dies.
In, too.
You do know it going in. It's, you know the story of the first... Of the first,
yeah.
you know, Star Wars.
You know that they die getting the plans,
yeah.
but they just, you know.
I love that movie.
Donnie Yen was in it, too. I like that.
Yeah. Here's Ken on WGN. Hi, Ken.
Hey, Nick. How's it going?
All right. What's up?
My biggest disappointment, sorry to say, dude, under your recommendation, the Blair Witch Project.
Well, that's a very divisive movie. Either, I don't know anybody who thinks it's okay. Only know people who hate it or love it.
Yeah. I went and saw it because you bragged about it so much years ago, and just I wasn't scared. It did nothing for me.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
All right. Well, like I said, that's a movie that you either love or you hate. I happen to love the Blair Witch Project. I think it's great. And I think it's very scary.
Yeah, I watched it last month.
It still holds up.
It was.
Ken, thanks for the call. It was. I will say this: Blair Witch 2. Oh my God! And then that last last Blair Witch thing that Weingard made that who's directing, by the way, Kong. He's directing Godzilla vs. Kong.
Yeah,
and Weingard who did a phenomenal movie called You're Next, which is a great movie.
It is,
and he did like VHS the couple of the VHS horror movies.
Yeah,
But he directed the last Blair Witch, and it was unwatchable.
Yeah, it's really it. I mean, it tried to go back to the roots.
Yeah, but
they totally messed up the atmosphere. It's they turned everything up too loud in a way.
It was terrible.
Yeah,
it was terrible.
And it started out under a different name too. It was just called The Woods, and then they're like, guess what? It's actually Blair Witch.
I remember when they surprised everybody with that.
Stupid.
Yeah, it was terrible. Man, I remember I saw that with my folks on a Saturday afternoon, and my parents, when it was over, my parents were like, what the hell was that? You know, they were both... So, 708 area code says, was a senior in high school looking forward to Led Zeppelin's In Through the Outdoor. When I finally heard it, I was almost in tears. I mean, it's not great, but it's not that bad. I wasn't in tears. I was disappointed. I was disappointed. 301 area code says, huge disappointment for me, the first Star Wars prequel, The Phantom Menace. This has got to be like high on the list
of like collective disappointments.
Yeah.
Probably. And even though I harbor some positive feelings, but that's because it came out when I was six.
Well, I mean, people had waited so many years for Phantom Menace. I mean, the hype was ridiculous. I remember seeing it at a screening and like people, you could feel the room turn on the movie. Like you could just figure everybody was packed. There was a lot of hype. But, like, literally about 45 minutes into the movie, you could just feel the people in the theater hating it. Just hating it. 301 area code says, Jaws 4 makes Jaws 2 look like a classic. Unlike Nick, I only like Alien and Aliens. The rest, not so much. I like all the Aliens movies. I know you do, too.
Oh, yeah.
You they're even great. Like those stupid Predator movies.
Oh, they're so good. Oh, man.
Oh,
God. It's about as trash gets, and I can't get enough of it. I
can't stand those movies. All right, we got a break here. What are you guys, what were your biggest disappointments pop culture-wise? 312-981-7200, talk and text. Get them in here, we'll read them, and you can call in and tell us what your biggest disappointments pop culture-wise were. And we got the news coming up in 11 seconds. This song, well, it's Madonna. So. True Blue. She wrote that song about Sean Penn.
Huh?
Yeah. Back when they were together. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're having some fun here talking about your biggest pop culture disappointment. Things that were all hyped up. It could be a TV show, could be a movie, could be a book, could be music, whatever. And we've got some texts here. We want to hear from you guys at 312-981-7200. Biggest disappointment pop culture related. 815 area code says, I would have to say that my biggest pop culture disappointment would have been Nightmare on Elm Street 2. It was unbearable to watch for me. Yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was terrible. It was terrible. Especially coming after that first one, because the first Nightmare on Elm Street is just such a great movie, and it came out of nowhere. You know, people knew Wes Craven. Obviously, horror fans knew Wes Craven, but came out of nowhere, and it is, you know, and as that series went on, and some of them are good. The Dream Warriors, the third one's pretty good. The fourth one, I love the fourth one. I thought the fifth one was good too. I hated the Freddy's Dead, where like the last 15 minutes was in 3D. I hated that one. But the first one was legitimately a scary movie, and then they just got jokier. It was just like Freddy Krueger became wacky guy.
So, yeah, I mean, he got famous for his one-liners,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, and it was, and then, you know, like, I will say this, that, you know, Robert Kurtzman and those guys who did the practical special effects on those movies, the effects were great, and they did have imaginative ways to kill teenagers. Especially the Rennie Harlan one, the one that Rennie Harlan directed, which was the fourth one, had some really great, one of my favorite kills in Nightmare on Elm Street's history was when the girl turns into a cockroach and she's in the Roach Motel. That's one of my favorite. That's seriously one of my favorite kills in the entire series.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, the second one was really bad. Really, really bad. But the first one's very scary. And I'll tell you what, when Wes Craven came back and did New Nightmare, he brought the big guns. That's a scary movie.
You like Dream Warriors?
Yeah. It's fine. You know what I mean? Of the sequels, well, besides New Nightmare, which is, I think, by far the best since the first one, and it's really scary. Wes Craven's New Nightmare is a very scary movie, and they took the humor out of it. They acknowledged it. They made it. It was a very meta movie, and that was a couple of years before he did Scream.
Yeah.
So that it was the precursor to Scream. So, yeah, but no, Nightmare, I remember seeing, I'm very excited for Nightmare 2 after how great and surprising and really scary the first one was. But, yeah, that second one was disappointing. Here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve. Steve? That was interesting. All right. 804 area code says, MJ's pro baseball career. Sorry. Were people really disappointed by that? Did you really think he was going to be able to play pro baseball? Did people really? I wasn't disappointed by it at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I didn't expect anything. I mean, the guy's an amazing basketball player, but that doesn't make him a great baseball player. He played for the Sox, too. So.
Hey, I for one, love the Sox.
Yeah.
Here on WGN.
Yeah, no, listen, hey, it's fantastic to have baseball back on this radio station. There's no question about it. 405 area code says, I really don't get disappointed in films, but the closest I got was probably Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I love Temple of Doom. Temple of Doom is my favorite of all the Indiana Jones movies. I like it more than Raiders. I think it's great. The only problem with Temple of Doom is Kate Capshaw, because you can't replace Karen Allen. You can't. And, you know, Spielberg was sleeping with her, so that's that's why she got the part.
You know.
But, you know, I was so excited for the Crystal Skull movie because Karen Allen came back.
Right.
And I adore Karen Allen. I don't know. I can't imagine any human being not adoring Karen Allen. And she's been in some classic movies, and, you know, and she's a major league crush for guys around my age. But I remember I was so excited about Crystal Skulls, but that was, oh my God, was that bad. That was a big disappointment right there. 316 area code says, Nick, Superman 3 and 4. Well, 3, I don't hate 3 because Richard Pryor's in it. So I don't hate it. It's not good, but I love Richard Pryor. The fourth one is unwatchable.
Now that's the one with like the
Quest
nuclear
for
man.
Peace. Yeah, yeah, Quest for Peace. Unwatchable.
Ugh.
And they stripped the budget down to nothing on that movie. The effects were awful. I remember there was like because the third one did okay. It didn't do fantastic business like the first two. And so that one, you know who produced the fourth one?
Who?
That was a Canon release. So that was like Golden and Globus.
Yeesh.
Yeah. And Christopher Reeve put his money up on that one, too, because he wanted to make a movie about peace. He wanted to make a movie, you know, about nuclear war and peace. It turned out terrible. Let's see if we can get Steve back on the line. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, I just want to switch gears. When the Stones released Some Girls, which was a great record, and then came out 2 years later with Emotional Rescue, that was just a letdown.
Yeah, Emotional Rescue is now, you know, there are people who defend that record. There are a lot of people who defend Emotional Rescue, and there's some stuff on it that I like. But yeah, I mean, especially following up. But then they released after that. That was they made another comeback because Tattoo You came out after
Tattoo
that.
You. Yeah, oh yeah,
yeah. And Tattoo You is a terrific record. So
yeah, that's when they got great.
Yeah, Emotional Rescue. But I got friends who backed that show, who backed that album, Steve. I really do.
Yeah, it was just a lull.
Yeah. All right, buddy. Take care.
All right. Yep.
Emotional Rescue. I don't know. That song cracks me up. I just. I am your knight in shining armor.
I think that was the only Rolling Stones album we had on CD. Because my folks, like my mom liked the Rolling Stones. She really liked, what was it, Some Girls. Some Girls was the record that she fell in love with. But
yeah,
we had that. We had Emotional Rescue on CD. And sometimes it would come up in like the CD changer. I'd be like, why is this happening?
Yeah. But I there's that stretch in the early 70s that just, you know, 5-6 albums in a row that are just the definition of rock, you know. But yeah, they tend to disappoint. Dirty Work is a terrible album, and they covered Harlem Shuffle on it. It's just ridiculous. But what about the solo career? Now, see, Keith's solo stuff is great. Mix, not so much. Because I'm lucky at love. Yes, I got the winning touch.
That's not a bad Mick Jagger. Maybe go an octave higher, but then you got it.
Yeah.
Well, what about his, everybody loves his version of Dancing in the Street with David Bowie.
Well, you know what?
That's a Stone Cold classic.
Well, it is. And the video is fantastic because it's so stupid.
Like, he's in like a turquoise shirt.
And they're both dancing around. They're almost kissing in it. And they shot it. They clearly shot it in 2 minutes. Like, they were just like, all right, we're here. Just get a camera. We're going to dance around like idiots for an hour.
Yeah, here's a fifth of whiskey. Yeah. Let's see what happens.
No, but I do have a soft spot in my heart for that. I do. There's no question about it. All right. On the same weekend in May, the much maligned Star Wars Episode I Phantom Menace celebrated its 20th anniversary, and Game of Thrones aired its final episode of the divisive final season, both events resulting in major disappointment for some fans. So we're asking, what is your biggest pop culture disappointment? They were asking some of the writers at the AV Club. First person, Randall Colburn, says, the answer to this question, I must admit, is informed as much by my experience watching the film as the film itself. So perhaps my aggressive disdain for Kevin Smith's Clerks 2 is unjust. It is unjust. Clerks 2 is great. It's great.
It is.
It's hilarious. I think I like it better than the first Clerks.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. But I think it's a hilarious.
It's hilarious.
Turn on what they were doing.
I thought it was great. I was in college, broke beyond belief, and despite having spent the day lugging my possessions down multiple sets of stairs in sweltering heat, homeless. I moved my possessions to a new apartment building only to discover that my unit was, for reasons beyond my control, not ready. As such, I moved my couch, desk, and 36 boxes and books up another flight of stairs to a friend's apartment to sit for 3 days. And with the last $15 in my bank account, I went to the movies to escape the heat, eat a dinner of warmed-over nachos, and for 90 minutes, I wanted to laugh. That's all. A few laughs. A pleasant story. The stakes could not have been lower. Alas, there were no laughs to be had in this horrible, unnecessary sequel, which had all the crassness of Smith's original and none of the homespun charm that so tickled me when I discovered it as a preteen. Soaked in dried sweat, I slumped in my seat, annoyed and exhausted, loudly declaring to the two people there in the theater, "This is stupid!" I was shushed, rightfully, and delirious in my dehydrated tantrum came this close to jumping ship. Then I remembered what was waiting outside. Heat, a sticky recliner, and an empty bank account. And I grimaced through to the ending. I haven't watched it since then. The mere prospect brings sweat to my brow. But I have considered how this story would be different had I seen another movie that opened that same day, M. Night Shyamalan's Lady in the Water.
He came out okay.
Yeah. Lady in the Water.
Oof.
Man, did that suck. All right. I got friends who back this, man. I do.
It's a solid bass line.
Yeah, it's just a dumb song, though. And the whole album's not very good. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. We are talking about your pop culture disappointments. What are the biggest disappointments? Somebody called in and said that Emotional Rescue by the Rolling Stones was a big disappointment for them. And we've got a bunch of texts coming in, and the phone lines are open if you would like to jump in here. It's 312-981-7200. Pop culture, biggest disappointments. 219 area code says, any Sharknado movie. Well, are they really disappointing? I mean, are there expectations for a Sharknado movie?
I mean, they all technically deliver on exactly what they are promising.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because if you're going to watch a Sharknado movie, and you go, well, you know, I really hope this is a good movie. It's not going to be. You will be disappointed if you actually expect a good movie with a Sharknado movie. Jimbo says, I was born in 1970. I saw the first three of the Star Wars movies, and that was it. I've never seen the rest of them, and I do not plan on it. I do not understand how they can make those after the first three. I think a lot of people would say that about the prequels. But I think some people are, judging by the reception of Force Awakens, there's still a ton of people who want to see these Star Wars movies. I know a lot of people were, there was all that backlash with The Last Jedi was just stupid. It was just stupid. I'm not even a Star Wars fan. I like those two movies. 262 area code says, Crystal Skull is the Indiana Jones movie that doesn't exist. No, it exists. I've seen it. It's a real thing. I love the fact that they replaced Jump the Shark with, what is it, Hide in the Fridge? Because when the nuclear bomb goes off, he's in a fridge and he's okay.
He's okay because it's a lead-lined fridge somehow.
It was so ridiculous.
He flies like 500 feet, man.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, like, the Indiana Jones movies aren't the most realistic thing in the world, and he escapes death, you know, countless times throughout the series, but that was really stupid.
That was beyond the pale.
And then by the time the monkeys were swinging around with Shia LaBeouf, I was like, what am I watching? One of the only times I disliked Cate Blanchett in a movie. One of the only times, because I adore Cate Blanchett. But, man, I can't wait to see her new movie. You seen the trailer for it?
Where'd you
go, Bernadette?
It's
Linkletter.
Oh, my God. I think it's based on a bestseller. I think it looks really fun.
I think she's fantastic. 224 Erica says RoboCop 3. Yeah. I didn't like the second RoboCop. I know a lot of people love the second RoboCop. Didn't like it. From the director of Empire Strikes Back.
Irvin Kershner.
Yeah.
He's a great director.
But 804 area code says Kate Capshaw was a replacement for Amy Irving. That's right. He was married to Amy Irving first. Yep. 630 area code says Black Sabbath's attempt at disco, all moving parts on Technical Ecstasy. Technical Ecstasy is a very strange record. It's a very strange record.
That's putting it mildly, man.
It is. And I remember when it came out, even the cover, I was like, what the hell is this? It's like two robots going up and down on an escalator. I was like, the hell happened to Sabbath? What's going on here? And then Never Say Die, which is a record that came out afterwards. It was the last Ozzy record until they reunited many, many, many years later.
And I like Never Say Die.
I do too. There's good stuff on it. It's just that Ozzy was barely there during the recording because that was at the height of his drug use and alcoholism. Like he would show up to the studio, barely be able to get through a take. And you can tell when you listen to that record. But there's some good stuff on it. But yeah, Black Sabbath, Technical Ecstasy. Very strange record. Here's Lance on WGN. Hi, Lance.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
I really enjoyed The Highlander when I saw it, the first one. And then the sequel to that was the most ridiculous thing I think I've ever seen on screen.
Yeah, it's a Highlander 2, The Quickening. We had somebody vote for that one earlier, and it is terrible. It is terrible.
Yeah, the first one was really enjoyable, though, and a great storyline. And then they bring in outer space into the story and completely destroyed it.
Yeah, it was received very poorly. You're right, Lance. All right, thanks, buddy. Have a good morning.
You too.
Highlander 2, The Quickening. Here's Doug on WGN. Hey, Doug.
Hey, how you doing?
All right.
Great show.
Thank you.
My disappointment was the first Live Aid with Bob Dylan. Everything about Live Aid was great, but Bob Dylan, for some reason, he must have had a cold. His presentation there was the only one that disappointed me.
Well, did you see Zeppelin?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's my take for the worst performance of that day. They were terrible, man. But yeah, I agree. Bob Dylan, I will say this, concert-wise, I tell you this, one of the most disappointing concerts I've ever seen in my life was Bob Dylan with Tom Petty. They toured together. Tom Petty was great. Bob Dylan was horrible. Horrible.
Yeah. He gave a great show at the Chicago Theater, you know, luckily, and redeemed himself to me when he was in his blues mode.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, he could be up and down.
Oh, no, that's true. That's true. Okay. All right, Doug. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Yep. Yeah, Bob Dylan was terrible. Was at Poplar Creek. And Tom Petty was great, as always. I mean, God, it's so sad that he's passed away. Tom Petty was one of the most consistently brilliant rock and roll artists of all time. Like, consistently. There are very few bad songs by Tom Petty.
And I wouldn't even call myself close to a Petty fan. I've always appreciated him, but I'm like, you know, it's Tom Petty I could give or take. But everything I heard, I was like, yeah, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
Every time.
No, I'm a big Tom Petty fan. My dad is, too. My dad's a massive Tom Petty fan. He's requested Tom Petty for, like, Two for Tuesday and Triple Play Thursday before. Yeah, he loves Tom Petty. He was great live, but I was really disappointed with Dylan. Like, massively disappointed with Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of concerts I guess, you know, I've been disappointed a couple times by The Replacements, but I knew what I was getting when I went in.
I really didn't like the Red Hot Chili Peppers when I saw them at Lollapalooza, but that was because that album was terrible. It was called, like, I'm With You or something, and John Frusciante, the previous guitarist, had just left the band, you know.
I saw him at the original Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
In 92, before you were born.
And that would have been nuts.
And it was great.
Yeah.
Well, that whole lineup was unbelievable. You know, the first three Lollapaloozas were pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And now I don't even look at the lineup.
Well, you know, now it's a four-day event, and it used to be just one day, and it would travel around the country. It was not located for 4 days in Grant Park. You know, like, I saw it at the World the World Music Theater, and whatever the hell they call that now, in Tinley Park, whatever it's called in Tinley Park. But yeah, this, you know, the lineups were pretty great back then in the 90s. So
that's when, what's his name was still Perry,
Perry Farrell. Yeah.
He was in control.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an interesting idea, and that, you know, and then they milked it, man. And it was interesting because of, like, what the idea was to have for one of the first times ever to have really different kinds of bands. You know, different genres of music all together. You know, throwing in the hip-hop there and all that stuff. It was. I remember when Fishbone...
I love Fishbone.
By the way, they just played here.
Do they?
Fishbone just played here, I believe, at Reggie's.
Oh, no way.
I think over the weekend.
Ah, oh, I love Fishbone. They're fun.
They're great. And they're
when it comes to ska, they're pretty much as good as it gets.
Unbelievable live band. Unbelievable live. Fishbone. Love those guys. I'm trying to think of what's the lead singer's name? Is it Andre or something? Because we dropped him on his ass. He crowd surfed at one concert that we went to.
And you dropped him?
We dropped him, and he went through the table.
Oh, jeez, man. Oh, what the hell?
This was at the Riviera. No, at the Vic. At the Vic. I think it was at the Vic, and we dropped him through the table. Like, he was like, my friend and I went, oh, oops.
Angelo Moore?
Angelo. Yeah. We dropped him through the table.
My God.
He got back up, jumped up like a maniac, and ran back up on stage. but he went through the table. Like, he busted the top of the table off. Because my friend and I dropped him. But yeah, those guys are amazing live. Amazing. All right, let's take a break. We got the news coming up after this. Sabbath rules. I love Black Sabbath. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Then at 5 o'clock, you got the opening bell with Steve Grzanich. And then at 6, the great Steve Cochran with your morning drive. It's Monday morning, everybody. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've been talking about biggest pop culture disappointments. What were you really looking forward to that really disappointed you in any sort of the entertainment world? 404 area code says, the last two Coen Brothers movies, Hail Caesar and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I like The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I hated Hail Caesar.
See, I'm the opposite. I liked Hail Caesar. I didn't really like Buster Scruggs all that much.
Oh, I hated Hail Caesar. The only thing in Hail Caesar, there is one scene in Hail Caesar that made me, like, cry laughing. And it's when Ralph Fiennes is playing the director and he's given the new actor notes. It's one of the funny. That is truly one of the funniest things I've ever seen. But I hated that movie. There's a few Coen Brothers movies that disappointed me. You know which one I hate that everybody loves? I absolutely can't stand Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I hate that movie. I hate it. I like the music. Soundtrack's fine. Horrendous movie.
That's now you're disappointing.
I remember I was sitting in the theater. I saw it the day it came out, and when it was over, I couldn't believe how bad it was. And when it was over, I kind of looked at the guy next to me who was like sitting two seats away. We were both just alone. Everybody else had gotten up and left, and I was just sitting there. And then I looked over at him, and he looked over at me, and we had like this moment where we looked at each other. And so I said, am I wrong, or did that really suck? And he goes, no, it really sucked. And I was like, wow. That's the you know which is the for me the most underrated Coen Brothers movie that I think is one. It's probably my second favorite Coen Brothers movie, A Serious Man.
Yeah,
that movie is unbelievable.
It's 10 years old this year, right? Is that 09?
It's got to be. Yeah, I think so. I love that movie, and it really it felt tonally very much like my favorite Coen Brothers movie, which is Barton Fink. But yeah, I like The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I thought it was good. A little disappointed that they did it for Netflix, but I don't know. But everybody's doing stuff for Netflix now. 773 area code says, one of my biggest cultural disappointments was the 1978 made-for-TV movie Rescue from Gilligan's Island. Not only was it poorly written, but Tina Louise wasn't in it. At the end of the movie, they go for a boat ride together and end up back on the same damn island. I have to claim that I do not remember the Rescue from Gilligan's Island. I remember the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island.
No, didn't do that.
Yes, they did. Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island.
Why?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And I thought it was way too much when they started putting them in Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
It's like, why were the Harlem Globetrotters being Scooby-Doo?
Well, they were massively popular. I mean, they're still popular. But
I love the Harlem
Globetrotters. When I was a kid, man, they were ridiculously popular.
Oh, man.
Let's see. 708 area code says Metallica, the Black Album. I love that album.
That was a huge album for them. Now, it's
yeah,
not
it was,
my...
but I guess, you know what it is? It's like the sort of the hardcore fans, you know, who like the heavier stuff.
Well, that I mean, that's when, like, pop metal kind of became a thing. They moved into, they were more like the hard rock category.
Oh, yeah, no, it was, it's definitely a departure. Yeah. There's no question about it. And, yeah. and I, you know, I can understand, you know, why really hardcore Metallica fans were disappointed. I think it's a great album. I think the Black album's phenomenal.
At least it sounds good, unlike And Justice for All, which is the worst mixed album of all time.
Yeah. 773 area code, disappointed in Aerosmith. Well, they haven't been good for a long, long time.
Like 40 years of disappointment.
It's been a really long time since Aerosmith has done anything that I could even remotely like. You know, and I loved Rocket Man, but Elton John for me is in that category too. Has not done anything good in a very, very long time. But the stuff that he did do good, which is covered in the movie, is phenomenal and some of my favorite music of all time. 847 area code says the ending of the show Lost. Well, we got that another vote for that. I was so invested in that, and the payoff was garbage and left plot lines unexplained. I know a lot of people who were mad about that. Dave says Rocky V with Tommy Morrison. What a turd. Siri, wait a minute. So you were disappointed by Rocky V, and Rocky IV was okay?
Well, Rocky IV was
Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's terrible.
It's iconic, though.
It is iconic, but it's also terrible.
I'm there solely for Dolph Lundgren. I must break.
I will say this though, and I gotta say that because Rocky IV. I know Rocky IV. You know, like to Colin and Eric and those guys. They were the right age when Rocky IV came out. They were the right age when Rocky IV was on cable every 5 seconds. So they watched it over and over again. So it's a cornerstone for a lot of generation people. People, you know, and they acknowledge it's a very silly movie. And I just didn't care. That was stupid. I just thought it was terrible. And so, but I will say this, when Creed 2 came out, and, you know, the whole storyline for Creed 2 was that Apollo's son was going to fight Dolph Lundgren's, Drago's son. And that was, that was like the whole plot of it. But I will say this, when he shows up, when Dolph Lundgren, and when Drago is sitting in Rocky's restaurant and they see each other for the first time, I will say that it really was like, it was a moment. It was like a breath moment where you go, ooh. 815 area code says, my disappointment was there was no Gymkhana sequel. I'm still waiting. That would be Brian, who has to mention Gymkhana every time we talk about anything entertainment-wise. 608 area code says, the second Boston album, which took 50 years to make. 50 years to make. Yeah, there was a lot of time between Boston albums. 630 area code says, Cowboys and Aliens, what happened? Well, were we really looking forward to Cowboys and Aliens? Was it something? Was there an anticipation for Cowboys and Aliens? That was a terrible movie. A terrible movie. But I will say this. It's the only time that it seemed like Harrison Ford was having fun in a movie in the past 15 years. You know, because Harrison Ford is a notorious grump. And, you know, he's in movies and, you know, like you could tell he just doesn't want to be on the set. But he seemed to be lively and having a good time in Cowboys and Aliens. One of the only thing in the movie that wasn't really terrible. 815 area code says, Nick, highly disappointed in the Buckaroo Banzai sequel. Oh, yeah, there wasn't one. That sucked that there wasn't. So he's disappointed that there's not a Buckaroo Banzai sequel. I can understand that, but the movie made $1.05. I mean, Buckaroo Banzai was a massive bomb. Now, granted, I love it. I think Buckaroo Banzai is great. And over the years, it has gained a huge cult following. Very passionate fans like Buckaroo Banzai. But you got to understand, from a commercial standpoint, the movie was a bomb. Like a massive bomb. So, there was not going to be a sequel. There was never going to be a sequel to Buckaroo Banzai. I mean, you know, now, maybe, because the movie's got such really, really strong fans, and now it's got a fan base that's pretty big, cult base that's pretty big. Maybe they can get away with doing a sequel now, but I think it's a little too late. But yeah, I love Buckaroo Banzai. I love that movie. John Lithgow, unbelievable. Laugh while you can, the Monkey Boy.
I finally did watch it.
Yeah, what'd you think?
It was great.
It's great, isn't it?
I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Laugh while you can, the Monkey Boy. John Big Booty. That movie's fantastic. Okay, we got a break here for some weather, and then we'll come back and talk more pop culture disappointments. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200, pop culture disappointments. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in a little bit, tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. Right now, though, we are talking about biggest disappointments in pop culture. What do you guys think of this? The people over at the AV Club did a little survey of their writers, and Caitlin Penny's Moog, said, I was hyped for the Hobbit adaptation, singular, and was disappointed in every single aspect of the adaptations, plural. Treating the Hobbit like a prequel to The Lord of the Rings and contorting Bilbo's adventure to fit the mold of Frodo's was a misguided approach. But it's not just the needless three-film redo that got my goat. It's the sheer heaviness of the adaptation that disappointed me. From the Necromancer subplot to the presence of Sauron's eye in the ring, like Hobbit, like Jackson and company sought with every change and addition to turn The Hobbit, a delightful, mirthful, warm book, into a ponderous slog. And I'm not talking about the length of the films. I sat through Lord of the Rings adaptations more times than I can count, often opting for the extended versions to the point I had to stop because I realized the repeated viewing was sapping the joy of the films from me. And I grew up reading and rereading The Hobbit, so it's kind of astonishing that how thoroughly Jackson lost someone like me, an avid fan, to the source material and his previous adaptations, with a product so dreary, so tedious, and so cumbersome that I can't even remember if I saw the third installment at all. My strongest memories of the films is the one of my husband's douchey co-workers who happened to be seated behind us in the theater saying loudly, that was a dragon.
Wow.
I didn't like the Hobbit movies very much
either. No, they're really... There's some bright spots. I give them a little bit more leeway than I think most people do, but that third one came around, it's literally like 2.5 hours of just battle scene, and it's not good battle scene at that.
Yeah, no, I was disappointed, real disappointed, considering how much I love the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Like, truly love the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
They sucked in a ton of people that never would have ever read the Lord of the Rings.
I'm one of them.
Yeah.
I mocked people who read the Lord of the Rings when I was in high school.
You would have stolen my lunch money.
And, it's funny because I never thought I was a nerd, but I was a horror nerd. I was a complete horror nerd. And so, you know, I would make fun of people who were like fantasy or sci-fi nerds, but I was a full-on nerd. I was a full-on horror nerd. And I used to mock people that read those books. And then I saw Fellowship of the Ring. I read The Hobbit when I was young. I didn't like it very much. And when Fellowship came out, and I saw the movie, I was like, oh, and I've told this story before, I immediately went to Simon's, the bar that I used to hang out at, and my buddy Jim's bartender there was a big fan of the books, and I used to make fun of him. And then, immediately after I saw the movie, I went straight to the bar and I said, Jim, I'd like to borrow the Lord of the Rings books from you. And he's like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, that movie was amazing. So then he gave me, and he had like the full box deluxe version, and I had a map of Middle Earth. It came with a map of Middle Earth so I can follow along to where the hobbits were on their on their journey. That movie's amazing. I mean, those movies, all three of them, are unbelievable. Return of the King is just, what can you say about Return of the King?
I embarrassed myself in front of all of my friends at a birthday party because his birthday was in December and lined up with the release. And we're like, oh, we're all going to go see the new Lord of the Rings. And the bit where they say goodbye to Frodo and he goes up to the Grey Havens. I was maybe like 11 years old. I was openly weeping in front of all my friends.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't regret it a single day.
I remember everything. When I saw Fellowship of the Ring, or I'm sorry, when I saw the Return of the King, we went to a midnight show before it opened. We went to a midnight show, so we got out of there at like 3 o'clock in the morning. But I went with a buddy, and we went with like two of my friends who really liked Lord of the Rings, and one guy who was in, you know, like whatever. And when it was over, the buddy who was like, he didn't care, was like, how many damn times did that movie end? Because
that's a fair criticism.
Because it does have like 20 endings, but I don't care. I invested a lot of time in a few years in those movies. They could have taken another hour for all I care. So, all right, let's go to the phones. Here's Roosevelt on WGN. Hey, Roosevelt.
Nick, thank you for taking my call. How you doing?
All right, what's up?
Rod Stewart, it coincides with what you said. You triggered a lot of memories from my high school and grammar school. I'm older than you, so. But Rod Stewart, I mean, the lineup on the Small Faces was ridiculous, full of talent.
Yeah.
You have Ronnie Lane, Steve Marriott, Ronnie Wood, and of course, Rod Stewart.
Right.
But then he turned into, I don't know, in my opinion, you know, he thinks he's Frank Sinatra. He went into all this stuff.
Yeah. I think it all changed with Do You Think I'm Sexy? That was where I was like, okay, man.
But you know what, Nick? Now you triggered more memories. Everybody went into disco. Even Santana did a disco song. I know because I have the vinyl of Santana. The Stones turned into disco during that era.
Kiss.
But you're triggering all these rock memories, and then you played Black Sabbath. I mean, I used to love Black Sabbath, and then Ozzy turned into a real weenie. I mean, and at the time, like you were talking about when you were a kid that you adored Elton John earlier on the last 2 hours. And to me, Black Sabbath was one of the best bands
ever.
And it's funny how you think when you're a kid, you know, you say, "Wow, these guys are great. They're into devil worshiping." But I mean, Ozzy was—he turned out to be a real weenie. I mean,
all right, Roosevelt, I got to run, but thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, take care. I guess the lesson that we learned this morning is that Ozzy would turn into a weenie.
That's bold, man. I hope Ozzy didn't hear him.
Here's the thing: when Ozzy left Sabbath. When they booted him from Sabbath, because he was a mess.
Yeah.
He was a mess. And then they brought Dio in. You know, Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules are both great records. And I was like, I don't know about this Dio guy. I'm not really sure. Because Ozzy, I mean, he's Ozzy. And then, you know, they went through a couple of other singers. And then Ozzy came back. But those Dio records... Heaven and Hell is a great, so is Mob Rules, but Heaven and Hell is actually one of my favorite Sabbath records in general, including all the Ozzy stuff. But the first six Black Sabbath records are perfect.
Mm-hmm. Once Ozzy figures himself, once him and Randy Rhoads get together, it's just a runaway.
The Blizzard of Oz, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Lightning in a Bottle and the live version, the live record that he released, the Ozzy live record with Randy Rhoads.
Very good stuff. Very good
man,
stuff.
Oh man, amazing. I like Diary of a Madman. I think Diary of a Madman is a great record. That was quite a comeback for Ozzy, man. Mm-hmm. It really was. You can kind of thank Sharon for that.
Yeah.
Cuz Sharon,
she told him to clean up.
He's always relapsed over the years. Yeah. And he fully admits that.
Yeah, totally.
It ain't easy, man.
No.
Here's Ike on WGN. Hi, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going with you,
All
man?
Right. What's up?
I'm surprised you haven't no one's mentioned this because this is supposed to be like the number one on the list. This is like a big example for pop culture failures. I'm sure you remember this. Geraldo Rivera composed a Vault.
Yeah, I thought it was hilarious that there was nothing in it. I thought it was hilarious because I can't stand Geraldo, and I just thought it was I laughed my ass off. Like everybody else, though, I did watch it. Like his ratings were through the roof. Everybody in America watched it that night, but my friends and I were watching it, and when it was over, I was on the floor laughing. So yeah, Al Capone's vault, so stupid. All right, Ike, thanks.
No problem.
Take care. Another vote for the Phantom Menace here. 773 area code. We're talking about biggest disappointments in pop culture. 773 area code says, I'm still waiting for Jaws 5. Why?
I'd watch it. Wow. I'd watch it.
I don't know about that. Who would be left? Quint's dead. Brody's dead. Hooper gets killed in the Piranha 3D movie. He's Hooper in that movie. I don't care what anybody said. He's Hooper. Did you see Piranha 3D?
Yeah, but...
Directed by the great Alexander Aja?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that movie. It's got that 15-minute scene of nothing but carnage is one of the greatest sequences.
Oh, it's incredibly fun.
Yeah, he's Hooper. I'm telling you, he's Hooper. And he gets killed at the beginning of that movie.
Piranha. So little did we know that Piranha 3D was part of the Jaws cinematic universe.
As soon as he showed
it's
up.
Essential,
he
it's was essential viewing.
He's sitting in the boat. He's wearing Hooper's hat. He's wearing his glasses. It's Hooper. It's Hooper.
Okay.
I laughed my butt off when that showed up. I'm like, look at, he's dressed exactly like Hooper. They never say his name.
That's what they were going for.
Yeah.
That's what they were going for. I think they could bring back Hooper. If they can bring back Rambo to do Rambo 5.
Yeah,
they could do a Jaws 5 with just know. Richard Dreyfuss.
I don't know if this Rambo thing, man. I don't know. Although the last one was fantastic. The last Rambo, which was one of the most violent things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. It was in like Burma or something.
Oh, it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. All right, we got a break here. The news is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're here till 5. Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And we have been talking about the biggest pop culture disappointments for you and me and everybody. And we've got some more texts that have come in. 440 area code says, any of the James Bond movies with Pierce Brosnan, that franchise took a big nosedive. Luckily, Daniel Craig returned to save it. Skyfall was the epitome going back to the original James Bond style.
Mm.
Pierce Brosnan ones were okay.
I really liked GoldenEye. GoldenEye was really good.
Well, GoldenEye was a big success.
That was his first one, right?
Yeah.
Him and Famke Janssen.
Yeah. World Is Not Enough isn't very good.
Yeah.
And I like the Timothy Dalton ones.
Yeah.
The Bond that I grew up with, my Bond was Roger Moore.
Oh yeah. The Saint?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best James Bond ever is Sean Connery, but you know, like the first Bond movie I ever saw in the theater when I was a little kid was Diamonds Are Forever, and that was the last Sean Connery one before he did Never Say Never Again, which wasn't an official Bond movie because it wasn't produced by the Broccoli's. But yeah, the Roger Moore ones just kept getting sillier and sillier. By the time A View to a Kill came out, it was like, what the hell?
Is that the one in space?
No, that's Moonraker. And that's unwatchable. that's by far the worst James Bond movie. Is Moonraker by far?
Is he A View to a Kill?
Yeah.
I liked A View to a Kill.
You did?
That's the one with Grace Jones.
Grace Jones and Christopher Walken. The big blimps climax at the end.
The song was Duran Duran.
Yeah.
I like it.
That's my favorite part of the movie is the Duran Duran song.
I just thought it was goofy. I thought it was
really goofy. It's really goofy.
Yeah.
773 area code says Limp Bizkit's Golden Cobra album. I'm not sure how anybody can be disappointed by Limp Bizkit. Okay. 309 area code says, I'm not sure why they made a sequel to Boondock Saints. The first movie was good. The second movie was pretty bad. I hated Boondock Saints. I thought that movie sucked. And I do not understand the massive cult following that that movie has. I just don't get it. I just don't get it. I don't know. You know, I don't even think I saw the sequel. I don't even think I bothered to see the sequel because I couldn't stand the first one. But people love that movie. It's got like a massive following. So, 434 area code says the remake of It sucks toilet water. No, it doesn't.
I don't know. I wouldn't say it sucks. I didn't really care for it all that much, but
really?
I thought it was well done.
I thought it was great.
I think the sequel, the second part, looks better.
It looks fantastic. Yeah. I thought the first one was great. I thought it was terrific.
I don't know. I made the mistake of reading the book, but right before I saw it,
yeah.
I spent like an entire month just reading this door stopper of a book, and then when I got to the movie, I was like, oh wow, they really couldn't fit all the parts that I really liked about the book in because it's 1,500 pages.
Well, first of all, I thought the miniseries was pretty good, not great, but Tim Curry is the man.
Oh yeah,
I mean he's
iconic.
The man.
It's iconic.
I love him. I wasn't as crazy about the miniseries, but I thought the movie version was great. I can't wait to see the sequel.
Because I think it's on the better end of Stephen King adaptations.
Oh yeah,
I'll say that much.
Oh yeah, I mean, but no, I thought it was great. I thought it was creepy. I thought Sarsgaard was terrific as Pennywise. I thought the kids were really good. And I thought it was scary. I liked that movie, and I was happy how violent it was. I thought maybe they were gonna,
Oh, I appreciated that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the sequel, Hader's in it.
I know you got Hader. You got
Jessica Chastain.
Yep.
McAvoy, for God's
James
sake.
McAvoy, he's the kid with the stutter.
Yeah. No, I thought it was good, man. I thought it was good.
It made a ton of money.
Yeah.
When I was working at the theater that weekend, it totally saved us.
It was,
we were crying for a hit.
It was packed when we saw it. When the theater was packed when my parents and I saw it. It scared the hell out of my mom. And when we went to go see Godzilla, they showed a trailer for It Chapter 2, and my mom went, oh, no. Because, they don't show Pennywise till the very end. But they're showing, like, balloons. At one point, Pennywise is floating with about 20 balloons. He's floating across the sky, but it's a real quick shot. And until he came out of the shadows at the final moment of that trailer and went, hi, my mom went, oh, no. Like, she verbally went, oh, no.
Not again.
It freaked her out, man. That movie freaked her out. It freaked my mom out.
Well, we used to mess with people in the theater because we had a single red balloon that we would hide in different places, and we would put them in the bathroom, and people would go into the bathroom, and
you'd audibly
hear them shout.
They'd
be like, no.
Hilarious. That is hilarious. Wait, here's a true story. After my folks and I saw it, they dropped me off at home, and then they stopped to get gas, down the road. And my dad texted me and said, we're at the Shell gas station, and there is a truck next to us on the other side, and in it is a guy dressed like a clown with a red balloon. And they had just seen the movie, and my mom was traumatized by it, and now she's got to see a guy dressed like a clown with a red balloon at a Shell station, like in real life.
That's too weird.
I thought it was hilarious.
It's great, but it's a little bit strange.
It was seriously
of all times.
We were 20 minutes out of the movie. Like, we had just seen it. And my mom was like, I don't need this.
Just up with the light on.
Yeah. And I read the book. I read the book a long time ago, though. So it's been a really long time since I read it. And I like the book very much.
It's a very good book.
I think the book
probably
is great.
My favorite Stephen King book, really.
Mine is...
Pet Sematary.
Well, it's the scariest.
Certainly the scariest, yeah.
I don't know if it's my film. I think my favorite might be The Stand. But I think Pet Sematary is by far the scariest. I mean, here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Yes, this was the most overhyped non-event of the past 20 years, I think. The reveal of the invention of the century, and they were going to show it on Good Morning America, and it was the Segway.
Yeah, I remember that.
A scooter, and it was going to change everybody's life, and the whole world was going to be moving around on Segways.
Yeah, I remember that. I vividly remember, all the hype around it because I was talking about it on my show. This was like 20 years ago. I think 99 is when they did this.
Yeah.
And so I was talking about it on the show, like, what is this invention? And we were like, you know, trying to figure out, trying to guess what it could be. What
it was, the code name was Ginger.
That's right. Ginger was the code name.
The same people that invented a thing, which was like a wheelchair that could go up and down stairs, and that was called Fred. And this was called Ginger as the code name.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's a great one, John. That's a great example.
Thanks.
Okay, take care. You were too young to remember that, right?
I was aware of it, because 99, I was in kindergarten.
Yeah.
So I was, like, more or less a conscious person, and I remember when Segways started, like, becoming a thing, and I was like, what is this? And my dad's like, yeah, it's stupid.
I could not believe that that's what it was. Like, I was sucked into the hype. I mean, they were seriously going to say it's a life-changing, it's going to be the greatest invention of all time, it's going to change everybody's lives, and the way we communicate, and the way we travel.
Certainly changed the way people take tours.
And I when I saw it, I was like, are you kidding me? This thing is the invention that's going to change everybody's lives? What? So Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, gets mentioned in this AV Club article. Which we got consistent, you know, votes for that as being one of the biggest disappointments in pop culture history. My friend Mike, who is a big Star Wars guy, original trilogy Star Wars guy, I remember when it came out, I'd known Mike for a long time, you know, and everybody waited. Well, what, Jedi came out in 83,
because
I was in high school. I saw Jedi like 2 days before I graduated high school and didn't like it. Again, at the Golf Mill where I saw Jaws 2.
It's cursed,
yeah. But I remember when Phantom Menace came out, Mike saw it and was so devastatedly disappointed by it that he had to go see it again to make sure it was that bad. Like, he went a second time. He went, like, 2 nights later, he went again. And he's like, it's horrendous. The second night that he went to the Webster place. And it was packed because it was just like it was the opening weekend. It was just a week. And it was before the word got out that it was a piece of crap. It was, you know, still people were very, very hyped about it. You know, Star Wars fans were really hyped about it. And to be fair, there are defenders of that movie.
Sure. They're wrong, but.
Yeah, they're wrong. They are wrong. But anyway, so there was a guy in the front row or near the front row that was sitting about three, four rows in front of my friend Mike, who was just like. Visibly, he couldn't take it because he was just like, oh, he was making moaning noises. Like anytime something really stupid happened, and he couldn't sit still. Like anytime something stupid happened, he'd be like, oh God, oh, and he'd be like going up and down in his seat and like, oh, putting his hands over his face. And so, at one point in the movie, I don't remember, you know, what they call it, but he has like they measured his Jedi juice or whatever the hell it is. What? And it was like off
midichlorians.
And it was off the charts, right?
Jedi juice.
Whatever the hell it is. And so his Jedi juice is off the charts. And they asked Liam Neeson. Or does Liam Neeson? I can't remember. Liam Neeson. They asked Liam Neeson who his father is.
Oh, yeah. No, and, he asked his mom. So,
and his mom. Okay, yeah. That's right. He asked his mom. Liam Neeson asked Anakin's mom. Who's the father? And she says he didn't have a father. And this guy who had been moaning during the movie just blurts out, oh, yeah, now he's Jesus. Blurted that out. And then and everybody in the theater started laughing. And then this continued. And at the end of the movie, the guy stood up and he turned around to the rest of the crowd. As soon as the credits popped up, stood up, turned around to the crowd. He goes, okay, how many people think that sucked? And then, like, people were like, he's like, I'm going home to watch Empire.
And let's hope he had the original tapes at home, not the special edition.
Yeah, the 97 edition. Oh, man. So, yeah, that was it. And at the screening, I was at a critic screening, which was also, like, a radio station-sponsored screening. So it had, like, critics and the public, who won. Yeah. Like, and it was packed. And we got there. We saw it at the 600 North Michigan. And We got there, and we got there an hour early. People were getting there like an hour early. And this was one of the few times that one of the first times I remember seeing like laptops and computers in the theater. Like people were online or they were messing around on the computers. And that also was a thing that happened at the Lord of the Rings screenings, too. So anyway, all right. But we're talking about the biggest pop culture disappointments of all time. You get the idea. 312-981-7200. We're going to take a break here for the weather, and we got some commercials to do. And when we come back, my dad's going to call in because it's Monday, and it's time for a jokey, jokey, jokey time.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey! What'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Right, yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday, and that means it's a Monday morning, which means my dad calls up and tells a joke. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, jokey time. Let's welcome my dad to the show. Hey, Dad.
I'm Nick.
How are you, buddy?
Good, good.
Good. How's Ma?
Real good.
All right, you got a joke.
Yeah, the joke. A fisherman was telling his friend about his dream he had the night before. He was alone on Lake Tahoe with a gorgeous woman. His friend said, "How did you make out?" He said, "Great, I caught a 6-pound bass."
All right. That's good. You know, because actually fishermen take that stuff very seriously, man.
Yeah, I know.
They do. Very good. Okay, Dad. Thanks, man.
All right, Ned. Take care.
See you later. There's my dad.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
Yes, he did, and he'll do it again next week, every Monday morning, right around this time. My dad calls in and tells a joke. All right, we have been talking about the biggest disappointments in pop culture. And for some reason, another in this AV Club article, another Kevin Smith movie pops up. Alex says, "I can't say I'm shocked to see another Kevin Smith movie on this list, but I also kind of can't believe that any experience with a different movie from his oeuvre would have as crushing disappointment as the impact on someone as Jay and Silent Bob Strike." But I think Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back is a really funny movie.
It's not my favorite. I think there are parts of it that I think are really funny, but it's also one of the most juvenile things he's ever made.
As someone who spent the late 90s thinking that Chasing Amy and Dogma were the peak of cool mainstream cinema, Dogma not so much.
See, I love Dogma.
Don't like Dogma. Big love Dogma. Chasing Amy.
Chasing Amy is very good.
It's my
really
favorite Kevin Smith movie. But yeah, I can't believe that all the... let's see. True, I finally got something approaching enjoyment thanks to Ben Affleck and Matt Damon's cameo as themselves on the set of Good Will Hunting 2, Hunting Season. But by then, the damage was done.
That was a good bit. And even Gus Van Sant appears.
Yeah, counting money. Kind of like a stack of money. I thought that movie was really funny. I did. Now, I disagree with this. Gwen Inat says, "It's been several years now, and I am still not over Gilmore Girls' April storyline in season 6. It took my favorite show down a path of plotline, pestilence, and plague, ultimately resulting in the Lorelai-Christopher marriage. I rewatched all of those seasons a few years ago for TV Club Classic, and the unholy hell of it was that Luke and Lorelai were on their way to being one of the rare will-they-won't-they TV couples that had a promising chance of working out. They were cute during their home renovations and even had... seemed to get past Lorelai's parents' disapproval of their relationship. Then April showed up, and Luke, for some reason, decided to keep his daughter's existence from his fiance a secret, even though, oh, you know what? Actually, now I'm coming back on this. That was a pretty weak season. That was a pretty weak season from a show that I adore, Gilmore Girls. Love that show. So a few more texts here. 773 area code says, "You want a pop culture disappointment? Two words: Seinfeld finale. What a stinker." Yes. Absolutely terrible. 312 area code, the remake of King Kong 1976. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Isn't Jeff Bridges in that?
Yeah, with a very magnificent beard.
Yeah, I remember catching some of it on TV.
It was Jessica Lange's first movie.
Yeah.
Really,
very poor.
It's really bad, and it's really long. Charles Grodin's in it. It's just a mess. And I remember when I saw it, I was 11 when it came out. So of course I thought it was cool. That's Rick Baker as King Kong in the suit. He also did the makeup effects. 708 area code says Terms of Endearment sequel. Why? It was awful. What the hell was the name of that? Evening Star. Terrible movie. Terrible movie, but Terms of Endearment is great. That's another reason.
Yeah, that's what makes it even sadder is that you had basically a really great piece of cinema on your hands. You could just let that be its own thing forever, and now you have to think about what's it called, Evening Star.
Evening Star was a terrible movie. I mean, it's not a based. Was it based on a book? Because I know James L. Brooks didn't have anything to do with it. I don't think James L. Brooks had anything to do with it. But Nicholson's in it. I think Shirley MacLaine is in it too, right? I think.
Mm-hmm. Juliette Lewis, Shirley MacLaine, Jack Nicholson, Bill Paxton.
Oh, man.
And it is based on a book.
Yeah.
The Evening Star by Larry McMurdo.
Yeah. AA708 area code says, I'm sure you're familiar with the story of David Hasselhoff when his rock star dreams came to a halt. When his pay-per-view event aired the same night as O.J. Simpson's Bronco Chase.
That's tough. That's a tough look.
Yeah. I'll never forget when that happened, man. I told you this story. I was at the Factory Theater in Rogers Park, and we were watching a really awful play. And so we went up to, what's the name of the?
You went to Bruno's.
Bruno's with the tap room. It's a liquor store tap room.
Yep.
Bruno's up in Rogers Park on Sheridan. And we went there to get booze because it was a two-act, and I wasn't going to be able to get through that second act without getting smashed. And so we went in to Bruno's, and nobody was in the liquor store part. Everybody was in the bar part, and everybody was watching TV. And we walk in, and I'm like, what the hell's going on? And they're like, O.J. Simpson's in the Bronco right now being chased by the cops. And I'm like, what? And I'll never forget it because they had the Bronco chase on the TV, and the NBA playoffs were happening at that time, and they were in a little square. They had the NBA playoffs like in a little square in the corner of the TV. But they were watching, it was the live coverage. And so we're standing there, and we got to go back and watch the second act of this stupid play. And, you know, the whole time I'm in the theater, I'm thinking, O.J. Simpson's going to be dead. Like, when we get out of the theater, O.J. Simpson's going to be dead. Like, the cops are going to kill this guy. But we all know how it ended. But yeah, that was one of the weirdest things ever. Walking into Bruno's and going, "What was everybody?" Yeah.
It's going to be the 25th anniversary this year. It'll be June 17th, 2019.
Is that right?
25 years.
Has it really been that long?
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is that my girlfriend's mom was in labor.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
With your girlfriend?
Yep. She's in labor.
She was born on that day?
No, I don't think she was born on the day, but she was, because, you know, it's like sometimes labor lasts like literally hours and hours and hours. Yeah. But yeah.
Okay. So everybody mentions, Eric Adams mentions that it's the, he gave up on Weezer after the Green album.
Smart move.
Everybody talks about that. I'm not a Weezer guy. I'm not a fan. I'm not a big fan. I mean, I'm aware of them, but there's always been. Have you seen the sketch where they talk about Weezer with Matt Damon, SNL?
Yeah.
One of the funniest things I've ever seen. Matt Damon's hilarious in that scene. That's a really funny sketch. So, all right. Well, there you go. Those are some pop culture disappointments. Every once in a while, we get disappointed by pop culture. Yeah. Who's on the show tomorrow? Is it Tom Appel?
Yes, sir.
Tom Appel. We'll talk cars with Tom Appel tomorrow.